Good afternoon. I call this meeting. I think there's some echo coming back. If you haven't muted your computer, please do so. Thank you. I call this meeting of Jobs Omnibus Conference Committee to order. This meeting is being held pursuant to Rule 10.01, a hybrid meeting. This meeting can be viewed on the House webcast. With that, I would like to ask the House Committee Legislative Assistant, Mr. Badri, to take the role.
Chair Noor.
Present.
Chair Noor present. Representative Eklund.
Present.
Representative Eklund present. Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Long present. Representative Stevenson. Representative Stevenson.
He's coming.
Representative Swadzinski.
Present.
Representative Swadzinski present. Representative or Senator Pratt. Senator Pratt. Senator Rarick.
Present.
Senator Rarick present. Senator Dames. Senator Dames. Senator Senjum.
Yes.
Senator Senjum present. Senator Friends.
Present.
Senator Friends present. Representative Stevenson. Senator Pratt. Senator Dames. Chair Noor, there are three members present and three members excused.
I think with the numbers, quorum is present, and we'll get to the order of the day. Members, we do have a full agenda today, and we want to start with the testimony from the commissioners before we do anything else. And I think there's sorry about that. We'll do the walkthrough from the nonpartisan staff for the commerce section. I don't know who will get started with that. Ms. Fontaine? The House?
Yep. Laurie
Pompop. Laurie Pompop will do the House sections for the commerce. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair and members. My name is Laurie Pompop, and I'm going to do the walkthrough for the commerce policy provisions. I'm looking at the unofficial first engrossment of Senate File 4091. I'm not using the side-by-side. There are no Senate companion language. So this will be the second document in the email that you received today. So I'm beginning on page 314, Article 28, Commerce Policy. Sections 1 and 2 relate to the Commerce Fraud Bureau. It changes their jurisdiction to offenses with a nexus to insurance-related crimes or financial crimes. Sections 3 to 9 relate to education courses for professions regulated by the Department of Commerce. This includes language regarding on-demand courses, live courses, proctors, and other definitions. These are mostly technical changes to update the language. On to sections 10 to 12. 19 to 22 and 24. These sections change the scope of the department's assessment authority against financial institutions. It expands their assessment authority and only accepts student loan servicers and collection agencies from financial institution assessment. These sections also require the funds to be deposited in the financial institution's account versus the general fund. On to sections 13 to 18, these require financial institutions to file their incorporating articles and all other corporate documents with the Commissioner of Commerce versus the Secretary of State. Section 23 updates language regarding safe deposit boxes. Sections 25 to 28 amend a variety of provisions relating to insurance company examinations by the Department. Section 29, it requires an insurer to notify the Commissioner of Commerce if the insurer materially modifies its anti-fraud law. Sections 30 and 31 change from 10% to 7.5% the amount of money the Commissioner can use from the auto theft prevention account to administer the auto theft prevention program. the date their report to the legislature is due is changed as well. Sections 32 to 34 and 51 to 54 make technical changes, removing or changing obsolete language. Sections 35 to 45 make changes to Chapter 80G regarding the sale of bullion products. These sections add a definition of Minnesota transactions and make related changes throughout the chapter. Sections 46 to 49 relate to real estate appraisers and make changes regarding minimum damage acquisition reports, out-of-state continuing education credits, and they clarify education requirements for real estate appraisers. Section 50 relates to preliminary applications to state agencies or boards that issue professional licensees. This section requires agencies and boards to allow people to submit a preliminary application to determine whether a criminal record or conviction makes them ineligible for a certain licensed profession. Sections 55 and 56 relate to debt collectors, and it gives them the ability to work from home without requiring a new debt collection branch license. Sections 57 to 59 relate to financing statements filed with the Secretary of State. Specifically, financing statements that are filed with the purpose to harass. These sections create a system to have filings filed with the intent to harass rejected, terminated, and reinstated. Section 60 relates to homeowners associations, and it requires an association levying a fine to provide certain notifications to a unit owner and give them a 15-day safe harbor period in between application of the levy. Section 72 is a reviser instruction, and Section 73 are repealers. I am now on page 363, Article 29, insurance. Section 1 allows the commissioner to authorize long-term care insurance to be sold in conjunction with life insurance if certain requirements are met. Section 2 relates to mandated health benefit proposals. Information submitted to the Department of Commerce that is trade secret must not be made public. Sections 3 and 7 relate to healthcare provider contracts and their contracts with insurers, and it prohibits termination not for cause, so there has to be a basis for the termination of the contract. Sections 4 to 6 and 8 to 10 make changes relating to dental provider contracts and their contracts with dental organizations. These provisions make a variety of changes relating to disclosures, the application of fees to payment methods, and network leasing. Section 11 prohibits discrimination by insurance carriers issuing life, long-term care, or disability insurance. And it prohibits discrimination based on the insured status as a living organ or bone marrow donor. Sections 12 to 34 relate to annuities and insurance agents and an insurance agent's obligation to consumers when they are recommending or selling an annuity. Section 35 requires the commissioner to study and report on disparities based on geographic rating area for health insurance premiums in the individual and small group market. Section 36 includes repealers. Now on to the last article. This begins on page 389, Article 30, Consumer Protection. Section 1 creates the position of student loan advocate within the Department of Commerce. This section outlines their duties and requires a report to the legislature. Section 2 requires the commissioner to create a library of equipment to combat auto theft. The equipment will be made available to all law enforcement agencies upon their request. Sections 3 to 11 and 14 relate to the purchase, possession, and sale of catalytic converters. Section 12 prohibits social media platforms from using an algorithm to target people under the age of 18 with user-generated content. And Section 13 requires debt collection agencies to send debtors contact information for Minnesota-based nonprofit credit counseling agencies, and it requires the commissioner to create this document to be distributed and maintain it. And that is all the policy provisions I have, Chair.
Thank you so much, Ms. Pampo, for your depth, analysis of the bill on the comma section. Any question, members? Questions? I see no any further questions. With that, we'll go ahead and do the testimony. So we start with Commissioner Arnold. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself and proceed with the testimony. I think she's outside, so somebody's grabbing. Good afternoon, Commissioner.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the conference committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. If you'll give me just one moment. My name is Grace Arnold, and I'm the commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. I'm really happy to be here. Thanks to the chairs and all the members for all the work on all the bills to get here today, and committee staff, of course, who are pulling their weight these days as well. So I'd like to briefly share my thoughts on the energy and commerce omnibus bills that are before the committee, starting with the budget-related items. I appreciate the House Energy and Commerce positions contain the majority of the governor's budget priorities for the department, and I also appreciate that the Senate energy position includes additional solar for schools funding that was in the governor's budget proposal. I'm pleased to see those priorities included, and I urge the committee's consideration of several important items that were not included. In particular, the $20 million State Competitiveness Fund, which was in the governor's budget proposal and does not appear in the Senate position of the Energy Omnibus. The Federal Infrastructure Act passed last year will allocate hundreds of millions of federal dollars to states, utilities, and communities across the state. The State Competitiveness Fund will provide funds to meet required matching contributions and short-term capacity needs to help businesses, the state, and communities across Minnesota compete for the opportunities created by this law. Our state will be left behind unless we are prepared with the funds necessary to seize this historic opportunity. I'd also like to encourage the Senate to adopt some missing non-energy position related governor's budget recommendations contained in the House position. These budget items will allow for additional or improved services to consumers and businesses in Minnesota across the various divisions within the Commerce Department. Regarding the policy-related provisions in the bills, both bills contain some strong consumer protections and provisions that will help move Minnesota to a clean energy future. I want to thank the chairs for the inclusion of the department's policy bills, and I'd like to highlight a few items in the House position that the department strongly supports. On the energy side, the $60 million for the Weatherization Assistance Program out of the general fund would help to lower energy bills for up to 15,000 income-eligible Minnesotans by making their homes more energy efficient and safe. As you may know, the Weatherization Assistance Program helps Minnesotans permanently lower their energy bills by as much as 30%. It improves safety and health and reduces demands on our state's overall energy infrastructure. On the commerce side, switching back and forth, clarification of the Commerce Fraud Bureau's authority and additional resources for the recommended statutory changes that were recommended by the Office of the Legislative Auditor earlier this year would authorize the Fraud Bureau to investigate other fraud allegations that are within the purview of the department's regulatory duties and identify an appropriate funding source for those additional investigatory activities. So with that, I'd like to again thank the chairs and staff for all the work on this budget and the policy provisions. I look forward to continuing to work with you. Happy to stand for questions.
Thank you so much, Commissioner Arnold. So members, any questions for the commissioner? Any questions? Those who are online, if you can raise your hand. I think we have Chair Long online, so... Representative Szczesinski.
Thank you, Chair Knorr, and to Commissioner. Appreciate that you are willing to come before the committee and talk about the bill in front of us. You know, you spoke on the $60 million for weatherization. and what that would potentially do. What other provisions and what other work is the governor looking to do to lower the cost of energy here in Minnesota? You know, families have seen just a large increase in their fuel costs, in their heating costs across the board. Has there been any talk within your office? You know, there's a lot of accounts that the state owns. The RDA account that is a tax on XL assets that, from what I can tell, have not been returned to ratepayers in this time of need. Where is the governor at on potentially returning dollars back to ratepayers to help ease the cost of energy?
Chair Knorr and Representative Swazinski, thanks for the question. So there are a lot of programs that are exist in current law. In particular, last year, the Conservation Improvement Program went through a really large change that will start to benefit consumers by lowering their energy bills permanently. I'd also like to highlight the governor's checks that were proposed to go back to Minnesotans. Some Minnesotans may be hurting with energy costs. Others might have different needs. And the purpose of those checks is to let consumers use them as they need.
Representative Zuzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you so much, Commissioner, for your testimony. We move to Commissioner Robertson from DLI. Commissioner, welcome to the committee and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and Conference Committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Roslyn Robertson. I serve as the commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. I want to begin by thanking Chair Knorr, Chair Eklund, Chair Pratt, and Chair Rarick for their diligent work and consideration of the agency priorities. I appreciate our partnership and engagement. The department is grateful that both the House and Senate increased funding for youth skill training, albeit at different amounts. The House appropriates the requested $747,000, which fund both grant increase and program administration, while the Senate bill appropriates $25,000 as a one-time. DLI urges the conference committee to fund the program at the agency requested amount. By growing youth skill training, more student learners will be better equipped to enter the workforce, and more employers will have an opportunity to develop the skill workers they need. I appreciate that both the House and Senate version of the bill include two fixes the department supports: the construction code and licensing fee reduction language correction, and the addition of effective dates in the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council recommendations that became law earlier this session. For the CCLD fee reduction for building permits and plans reviews, the department preferred the sunset date of October 1st, 2023. In the House language, as it provides the department the opportunity to evaluate the balance of the construction code fund to determine whether an ongoing fee reduction is fiscally reasonable. Regarding similar language in both bills, the department preferred the House language on window cleaning anchors, as it provides for expedited rulemaking and indicate that the state building code must include a nationally recognized window cleaning safety standard. The department has no preference on House or Senate language that provides an exemption from elevator contractor licensure for work on conveyors, platform lifts, and dock levelers, and understand stakeholders are near agreement on a compromise on the load management device provisions. We look forward to a resolution that adequately protects the safety, the public safety. To continue with the construction code and licensing proposal in the bills, the Minnesota Plumbing Board unanimously objected to the Senate-only provision to exempt repair or rebuilding of irrigation system backflow preventions from plumbing licensure. The House-only language raising the fee threshold for the annual municipal development-related fee report and requiring the department to establish a cost per square foot evaluation method for setting building permit fees for one and two family dwellings were recommendations of technical experts on the Construction Advisory Council. And the department has no objections to these recommendations. Moving on to the Senate-only provision in the jobs article, the department appreciates the $175,000 in funding for police officers, state troopers, and firefighter benefit adequacy study, but suggests the $50,000 appropriation for a grant to an organization to provide equine experiential mental health therapy to first responders is better directed to the Commissioner of Public Safety. The department has concerns with Senate-only provision that seeks to amend the employee notification and provisions of the wage theft law. Many of the changes in the bill reflects how the department has interpreted current law and is therefore not needed. Other provisions we object to as they undermine the intent of the law to prevent and address wage theft and ensure employees are paid the wages that they are owed. I appreciate the House inclusion of provisions to increase worker safety. Among them is the proposal to require petroleum refinery contractors to participate in registered apprenticeship for work in the construction and maintenance of petroleum refineries, as it would ensure workers have access to the skills and training needed to perform these jobs safely. The $500,000 in additional funding for logger safety grant would be welcomed by the logging industry. The agency awarded the full $1 million appropriated for logger safety grant last session to 61 applicants. The funding enabled those employers to purchase or maintain recommended safety equipment and invest in training to reduce the risk of injury to their employees. I strongly believe that the agency's additional supplemental budget priorities included in the House version of the bill should be adopted by this conference committee. OSHA federal penalty conformity would ensure continued federal funding and would encourage employers to continue to take workplace safety and health more seriously. Minnesota OSHA is referred to as a state plan, which means the Federal Department of Labor delegates authority to Minnesota to enforce workplace safety and health laws. As a state plan, Minnesota receives up to one half of its funding in the form of matching grants from the federal government. To meet the requirements of these grants, Minnesota OSHA must be at least as effective as federal OSHA. If Minnesota fails to comply with federal penalties, the state risks forfeiting Minnesota OSHA administration to the Federal Department of Labor. Then the higher penalties would go into effect without the mitigating factors that Minnesota OSHA applies. Conforming with federal law is a requirement, and failure to conform puts the state OSHA program at unnecessary risk. $1.375 million increase for registered apprenticeship and LEAP grant would enable the agency to reestablish a separate division of apprenticeship within the Department of Labor and Industry, and it would also increase the participation and retention of women, people of color, and indigenous people in registered apprenticeship programs. Due to the growth in the apprenticeship program and the labor standards unit, apprenticeship needs its own director to meet its statutory obligations and meet the needs of its stakeholders. The House proposal for earned sick and safe time and paid family and medical leave are needed to support hardworking Minnesotans. Many workers cannot afford to take unpaid time off to care for themselves or for a sick loved one. And these workers may be forced to go to work sick, putting customers at risk of also becoming ill. The COVID pandemic has demonstrated now more than ever, Minnesotans need paid time off, both earned sick and safe time for short-term illnesses and paid family and medical leave for more serious medical and family caregiving needs, so that they don't have to make the difficult choice between caring for themselves or loved ones and paying their bills by going to work. The House includes a $1.758 million increase for prevailing wage enforcement. Prevailing wage laws exist in Minnesota to ensure projects funded whole or in part with public money are constructed and maintained by the best means and highest quality of labor reasonably available, and that persons working on these public work projects are compensated according to the real value of the services they perform. The prevailing wage increase will ensure the agency can meet its enforcement and education obligations due to the influx of federal funding for public infrastructure projects coming to the state that would be subject to the prevailing wage laws. The House also includes a $150,000 general fund appropriation for the Office of Combative Sports and policy changes aimed at better protecting combatant safety and health and ensuring that Minnesota combative sport regulations are consistent with other states and jurisdictions. The proposed changes closes regulatory loopholes, improve event security, clarify pre-licensure requirements, and establish statutory procedures for challenging the outcome of a combative sport contest. These changes are needed as Minnesota plays an important and growing role in the combative sports regulations. The agency proposal for fair labor standards for agricultural and food processing workers are recommended by the Committee for the Safety, Health, and Well-being of Agricultural and Food Processing Workers and would expand protection and build awareness of workplace rights for this group of workers. The Commercial Energy Code improvement would help put Minnesota back on track to achieve our greenhouse gas reduction goals. Assisted living facility plan review and inspections would ensure safe housing for the elderly, and the 2-year license fee holiday for building code and construction trades would provide economic relief to an estimated 79,000 licensees. I'm also very pleased that the House position includes providing unemployment insurance benefit eligibility to hourly school employees. The proposal will support the economic well-being of these workers and will aid in employee recruitment and retention for these important staffing positions. While I recognize that this is a supplemental budget year, making these investments now will enable the agency to better meet the needs of Minnesotans we serve through safe working and living environments, high-quality workforce training programs, and improve workplace protection. I thank the committee for your time, and I'm happy to respond to your questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Members, any questions? Chair Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Robertson, thank you. I got two questions. It looks like you laid out your priorities here, but it seems like between what the House bill's done and what you laid out for priorities that we're focusing on safety and training of the workforce. Would that be correct in saying what you just presented, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Chair Eklund, that's correct.
Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the final question is, what would happen to, say, an industry that employs 100 people or 50 people on this federal OSHA compliance issue if we don't comply with federal OSHA requirements?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Chair Eklund, what would happen if we fail to conform? We continue to put the Minnesota OSHA program at risk. We've been put on notice by federal OSHA of our failure to comply with the increase in penalties as included in federal law. As I've explained to the committee a number of times, our core obligation is to be at least as effective as. If we fail to do that, we risk our Minnesota OSHA program being forfeited back to federal OSHA. If federal OSHA takes over the Minnesota program, the fee increases that we are concerned about today would automatically go into effect, and federal OSHA does not have a similar penalty grid that they take into consideration an employer's experience with Minnesota OSHA, the severity of the citations that are issued, and the number of individuals that are impacted. We at Minnesota OSHA, we have this penalty grid. We take those factors into consideration, so we always have space at the table for employers. Those employers that demonstrate that they have safety protocols in place, they have a strong history of having the Minnesota AWARE program in place, those employers receive a significant penalty reduction. For some employers, those penalty reductions can be up to 90% of the penalty assessed. Federal OSHA does not have a similar approach to penalties, and therefore the penalties would go into place, and our Minnesota businesses would be required to pay the higher penalty as issued, as well as we would lose our opportunity for having state resources available to respond to Minnesota's specific needs.
Chair Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. So basically, if we don't conform with federal standards, it takes away our flexibility, and it's going to cost our employers most likely more money out the door just because of automatic penalties.
Mr.
Chair, Chair Eklund, that is correct.
Chair Eklund. Representative Swierczynski.
Thank you, Chair Noor. And just a question to the Commissioner, two questions. What in the House version does the Commissioner not like of the bill?
What's in the, Mr. Chair, Representative, what's in the House version that the department does not like? Well, I'm quite appreciative of all that the House version has included. I'm not sure that there's anything in particular that we do not like or could not support.
Mr. Chair, follow-up to that question. What would the governor's office and yourself would like added to or included in the House version, if you had your wish list?
Commissioner Robertson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would need to just give that a little thought before I respond.
While the commissioner is looking on the list of items, I think that we received from the governor's recommendation, I can assure you that we did not fund every aspect of the governor's request. As the chairs, we prioritize, we may agree on, but then the language that we usually have is based on the priorities that the members in the House of Representatives and the Senate senators have brought forward to us. So if you ask me about the other sections, which we'll be talking more about it, I think every chair has got a priorities that are included in, and it's based on what the House members have brought forward to the chairs. And I can assure you that there are many things that the governor will have wished is included as part of the conversation today, but that may not be likely in the bill that we're looking based on the conversation we've had with the departments. As always, it's good to have the department on your side on most of the issues. They're the ones who are going to implement all these things. For example, we're talking about OSHA conformity. That's beyond just the, you know, coming from a wish list from the governors. It's a required process. I think it's a federal conformity that many states are doing. So all those things are inclusive, and those are things that we have to be able to address as a state. Commissioner, if you wanted to add anything else to that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe the House provision is quite extensive. We've had good conversations with our chairs, and they include the items that the governor has identified as priorities for labor and industry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Chair Sanjay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, thank you for being here today. I'm asking a question that's a little bit out of my wheelhouse because I haven't followed this issue as closely as maybe I should be to have the privilege of asking my question. But the wage theft thing, at least with a lot of employers of the Rochester, in Rochester, was found very onerous and costly even. And these are good people. They love their employees. They need their employees. They're certainly not going to cheat their employees. But nonetheless, this was a fairly onerous statute to follow, and perhaps still is. And I don't understand, and I think your testimony today was something to the effect that you would reject whatever we have in here to try to maybe mellow it out a little bit. And I'm not sure what's even in here because I'm not on your committee, Senator Pratt, and I don't know where we're going on this. I would be interested in hearing your objections to trying to make this work just a little bit better in Minnesota, because the statute certainly as originally, you know, as it went out of this state capitol a couple years ago, was met with a lot of concern, a lot of feeling about a lot of arduous work that was totally unnecessary from the standpoint of many good employees that, again, they're not going to cheat their employees anyway. They need them. They appreciate them. They love them. These are precious commodities for a company. So I'd just be interested in hearing your reaction. Why can't we fix this if you're objecting to fixing it?
The wage theft issue, I think we have deliberately brought all the stakeholders and have a lot of conversation about this issue. And I think we have got a very great program as a whole when you look at the wage theft and how that is being implemented. But I'll let Commissioner Robertson, I think also Chair Eklund, to jump in. And also, I know,
Mr. Chair, if we fix it on our side, you know, Senator Pratt, if it's fixed, it's fixed. I'll withdraw anything I've said.
I think Chair Pratt is ready to respond.
If it's not
to that.
Fixed, I'd like to understand why the commissioner would be opposed to fixing it.
Chair Pratt,
thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Senjum. The department has made some changes in the rules. And the guidelines that they have put out there, and those have been helpful. The concern that I have is that if we were to get an activist commissioner again in that role, they could utilize the ambiguity in the statute and re-implement those very stringent and hard to comply with rules that they did before. They went well beyond what the spirit of the law was when Representative Mahoney and I worked on it. There are some other pieces. I would disagree with my colleague in that we have pulled together all the stakeholders. We've tried. We've heard some recommendations from employers that we've incorporated into our bill. I've purposefully reached out and with Commissioner Robertson to talk to the labor representatives. I've asked for feedback. I've asked for recommendations, and I have not received any response from those groups. And I have indicated before, and I'll indicate again, the goal of this bill should be to protect our employees from having their wages stolen. And there was just recently an article about some egregious efforts that went on in the construction of a major project here in the Twin Cities. We don't want to weaken any of the protections, but we do want to have a balance between the employers and the employees. And this was never intended to be an administrative burden on our employers either. We know that a vast majority of our employers, like you said, treat their employees well, treat them like family in many instances. And this has become an administrative burden, and it's gotten in the way, and we're just trying to rebalance where we have. So I would put a little different perspective on it than Chair Knorr has just laid out.
Thank you, Senator Pratt.
To the commissioner, Commissioner Robertson, did you want to add anything else to that, or should I let Chair Eklund?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator St. John, I appreciate your comments, and to a high degree, I appreciate the concerns that Chair Pratt has raised. Labor and industry has continued its engagement with Chair Pratt around this issue. We've talked about items that the department has, because of the concerns that have been brought to our attention. We have accommodated many of those concerns in our interpretation of the existing law. There are, however, other changes that is being recommended that the department does object to. We have continued our engagement with the Wage Theft Coalition, which was the group that had worked on this issue for a number of years prior to the final enactment. We know that the original law was a broad agreement by many different entities, and we believe that changes to this law should also be supported by those broad entities. I have continued the engagement with Senator Pratt. I have clearly indicated those areas where the department does have any discretion in its interpretation. We have taken his suggestions and implemented them to the degree that we can at the agency. And we believe that some of those provisions are not needed because it is the current interpretation, whereas other provisions that are being suggested would clearly weaken the wage theft law and have impact on those employees that are intended to be covered by this provision.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, thank you very much. I do appreciate your efforts as you're able to make them, and this is important, and I just wanted to bring the topic up. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Chair St. John. So any further questions? I see Chair Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator St. John, we heard so much about this whole wage theft thing that against probably the advice of my committee administrator, we scheduled it last year for, I think we gave it about 45 minutes in committee. If there was a large group of employers that were dead set against how this provision was running, they certainly didn't sign up to testify in front of us. I think our committee hearing lasted about 20 minutes when we gave it 45. So I think there's maybe some concerns out there we have to talk about, but they certainly didn't make themselves known to us last spring.
Senator Fentz.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. I guess a question for those that work with the Wage Theft Coalition. Are there recommendations of the Wage Theft Coalition that are not currently being adopted? I guess that would be to the commissioner. Thank
commissioner
you, Mr.
Robinson.
Chair.
Mr. Chair, we do have some members of the Wage Theft Coalition, and we do think that there are indeed other provisions that could be considered. There hasn't been any consensus around those issues, so we are not prepared to make any recommendations today.
Senator Fentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. I think that's the question. If the Wage Theft Coalition were to reach a consensus, I think it's incumbent on us to take a look. And thank you very much for the testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Warrick.
Thank you, Chair Noor. To that, I guess I want to say, you know, as someone who carried a bill that was brought up earlier today, with the reform of SIP, the provision that we have that we've worked on for 3 to 4 years that we're finally coming to agreement with load control, I think the coalition came up with language, but many in the work side, employer side, were not in agreement with that wage theft law. And we rammed that through in one session. I think everybody in that sector believed we'll get through this, and when we come back with recommendations, people will be open because we rammed it through so fast. Unlike so many of these other big pieces of legislation that take 3, 4, 5 years to get through. So the fact that Chair Pratt really worked through this and convinced Republicans to get this done because it was important, and he was banking on the idea that this coalition would work with him. And I remember I went out to one of my school districts that next summer. I went to one of my electric cooperatives, and that was the first thing that when I walked in the door, they said, you need to go talk to our HR person. They've got problems. This is very onerous on them. They need some reforms. And that has not been listened to yet. So when we talk about the OSHA conformity then as well, we talk about that we need to be as effective. And I have continued to bring up the idea that we are as effective. We're more effective than all the states around us with our OSHA program. Our companies do not have high rates of injuries. So just to say that the penalties that we charge is what makes us effective, I think is absolutely false narrative. But it's like, please engage with us on some of these other important things if you want us to engage on these other areas. It goes both ways. And I get very, very tired of when I've worked so hard on so many different pieces of legislation to get everyone on board before it goes through. And then I keep hearing about this, that where it went through so fast without everyone on board and an absolute refusal to engage and talk about common sense changes that will make things easier. Thank you.
Commissioner, did you want to respond? I know I had you differently when you spoke about those two issues.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Rarick, Chair Rarick, I can really appreciate your concern here. However, I don't think it is a fair comparison to compare OSHA conformity requirements to wage theft. OSHA penalty conformity is a directive from the Federal Department of Labor, Federal OSHA. So it is not upon us to opine as to what is determined to be at least as effective. This is a criteria that Federal OSHA uses to measure all state programs, and so it's not within us to decide that because of Minnesota experience rating that we are, in fact, at least as effective when federal OSHA, who is our grant partner, has deemed otherwise based on our failure to increase the penalties. I do appreciate your concern and the amount of effort and engagement that you have participated in many of the issues at labor and industry, and we've been right there with you. But I do see these issues as considerably different.
Thank you, Commissioner. I don't see any further questions. If you have any closing remarks.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair,
Chesson.
30 seconds. I will tell you, I was at the other end of an OSHA inspector from 1970 to 2008. And I will tell you many, many, many times, it's not the fine that makes the OSHA inspector or even the process important. It's how they conduct their business. I was fortunate enough to have good people working with me from the state side, and we did a pretty good job, I think. But that had nothing to do with the penalties. That had a lot to do with the relationships and talking things through and making things work. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Sanjaman. I think that's what likely the commissioner will tell you. It's about the relationships. And so with that, Commissioner Robertson, if you have any closing.
Thank you very much for the time and opportunity to share our priorities.
Thank you, Commissioner, for your testimony. Now we'll have Commissioner Grove. Good afternoon, Commissioner. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Grove, and I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And I want to thank you all for having me here today. Excited to have a conversation about where this group can go together. Chairs Pratt, Chairs Knorr, Rarick, and Eklund, thank you in particular for your hard work on Senate File 4091, the Omnibus Jobs, Energy, and Commerce Bill. It's been a long and productive session, and we've already got some wind in our sails. We have done a great job so far passing a historic UI replenishment bill for the state of Minnesota. We've passed an extraordinary frontline worker package that will help workers across our state. This should be wind in our sails as we head into this final week to take more proactive measures to help grow our economy. I think it'd be a mistake to consider that our work is done at this point. Those were two major packages, but in many ways, they're just kind of wrapping up the unfinished business of the pandemic. And the opportunity we have ahead of us now is to make progress, to be proactive, to look towards the future of our economy and where it's headed, and to put our businesses and workers in a position to succeed at a highly competitive time in America. We face record workforce shortages, as you all know. I'm sure you hear this in your districts every day. Over 200,000 job openings in the state. And we need to make sure that the great resignation just becomes a great transition, that people are moving to better paying jobs, to jobs of the future at a critical juncture in our economy. We've got a very deeply competitive business climate right now. We are fighting with other states, with other countries for workers, for business expansions every single day. And new business starts are about 40% up, which is good news. We've got to make sure those expansions happen here in Minnesota. And we face a racial reckoning here in Minnesota with income disparities and inequities that were accelerated by COVID and were really highlighted for the world in the wake of the killing of George Floyd in 2020. We ignore the opportunity to make progress there at our own moral and economic peril. The good news is, of course, we've got a record surplus to address it all, and we're waiting on the final details of what this committee's target will be, but we know that there are priorities that make this moment one that's really important for our economy. So let's talk about some of those priorities here today. The first selection of things I'd like to talk about is economic development. The House's bill in particular makes some really great investments to ensure we have an equitable economic recovery here in Minnesota. One of those is to put more money into a program called the Main Street Economic Revitalization Program that Chair Pratt, Chair Knorr, myself, and several others put together last session. It has already gotten $40 million out the door, with $40 million coming tomorrow. This is rebuilding our main streets after a very difficult couple of years in our state. We strongly recommend this committee consider putting more money into that program. There is a lot more need than we have met so far. Second area that we're excited the House has supported deeply is a marketing campaign for Minnesota. As I said before, it is deeply competitive out there right now. We are fighting against our neighbors who are trying to eat our lunch. They're sending commercials into our state, programs trying to get workers to come over, work elsewhere. Minnesota has never adequately or even remotely marketed our economy as a place to come and live and build a business. And, you know, we're not expecting a $1 billion marketing budget, but we'd like something that's above zero. And we have in our budget around $5 million for that. The House has some money as well. This is the moment where we have to market Minnesota to the world. We ignore doing that at our own peril. And in addition, we know that with small business starts being a major opportunity in our economy right now, we've got to make sure that the highest rate of businesses who start can succeed in our economy by giving those small businesses the technical assistance that they need. And so the House and the governor's budget both have some small business assistance dollars in that budget to help new businesses get off and get started at a critical moment in our economy. The House, I think, kept the equity at the center of their budget. We applaud you for that. And also for including many of our policy changes. The Senate included many of those policy changes as well. One other area in economic development I want to lift up here, since we have our energy colleagues in the room as well, is the Energy Transition Grant Program. This is something that is in both the House and Senate's bills, slightly different amounts than what the governor put forward. But look, this is money that we can use in communities in Minnesota where we know with definitive fact a coal plant shutting down pretty soon. And what's that community going to do next after the coal plant goes away? We need new jobs in that area. We need energy transition dollars. These grants will help those communities transition. I want to applaud both the House and Senate for seeing that as well. I think that's something we can work together on this session. A couple things on economic development that were not in either package but are in the governor's package, and I did want to highlight here. One is additional funding for Launch Minnesota. This is our flagship program for startups in our state. It has helped put Minnesota's startup ecosystem back on the map by providing early-stage funding to entrepreneurs to take that risk and start something new. We see a huge opportunity to put more money into that program to help businesses scale up. So you've started up, you've gotten going. How do we scale you even further? That's the gap that we see in Minnesota's startup ecosystem right now and what the funding that we recommend there would do. Second is a focus on electric vehicle infrastructure for businesses by helping accelerate our transition to a green economy and creating those jobs that we know are going to be the jobs of the future, and we want Minnesota to be a leader in them. Those EV dollars would make a big difference from our economic development perspective. And lastly, I'm concerned there was no investments in either bill in the Nonprofit Resiliency and Recovery Fund. This would help Minnesota's nonprofits rebound from COVID. They were never eligible for so many of those grant programs that we put forward during the pandemic. And they have kept so many communities afloat during this time, and we urge you to consider supporting them as well. Let's talk next about workforce. You hear about workforce every single day from the employers and the workers, I'm sure, in your districts. This is the most pressing concern I hear, certainly as your commissioner of this department. And when we looked at our budget at DEEB, we looked at where the gaps were. You know, what tools do we not have to serve the needs that our economy feels today? And in the House bill, you'll see some of those, and in our bill, you'll see more. One of the major gaps we see is in our technology workforce. These jobs are growing at around 12% compared to about 5% growth of the rest of our state, and they pay about twice as much on average. So these really are the jobs of the future, and not just in software companies, but in every company. Having a technology-proficient workforce is critical to growth, and you got to train for the jobs you see coming, not for the jobs that are going away, and we highly recommend putting workforce dollars towards technology training, both for youth and for adults who want to reskill. Again, so many people during the last few years have stopped and said, you know, what's a good job in our economy today? What's a good career path for me? And more often than not, those who are doing their research find that a career path in technology is that path, but it takes a little training. So we have money set aside both for reskilling for adults and for youth, with a strong focus in both of those programs on BIPOC individuals who are vastly underrepresented in those industries and for whom extra skilling and training is particularly important. Lastly on workforce, I want to highlight the extraordinary community of new Americans we have in Minnesota. This is a population that is solely responsible for any population growth we've had over the last 20 years. I mean, that's why Minnesota has grown, immigrants and refugees. And the last thing you want is an immigrant refugee coming into Minnesota with a PhD and driving an Uber around. That is not using your workforce effectively. We need to have very specific supports, very specific outreach focused on immigrants, refugees in our economy if we're going to take advantage of these next 20 years of incoming citizens to our state. And we have put forward, and the House has supported as well, an Office of New Americans to do just that, to focus on workforce, to build bridges between employers and immigrant communities in the workforce so that the smaller businesses who don't have a multilingual HR team can access new Americans and new Minnesotans really, really effectively and quickly to help grow their businesses. This is a very small item in our budget, about $500,000, but we think a huge sign and a huge opportunity to grow our workforce in Minnesota. Lastly, before I wrap and take any questions you might have, I want to talk about worker supports. You know, I think everybody in this room learned a lot about our social safety net these last few years. It was stretched beyond unimaginable belief, and there's not an American today, I think, that isn't aware of what unemployment insurance is, what paid family medical leave is. These are policies that have just made it to the center of the American discussion on how our economy works, and they're outdated. They are outdated. They are programs that you would not create today if you were putting together these programs. We have to fix them. We've done some good work on that so far, but there is work left to go. Let's start with paid family medical leave. This would provide Minnesotans with a safety net when they or their family have a serious medical issue or the birth of a child. And this isn't some newfangled idea. This is simply what every modern nation does around the world to take care of their workers. It's also what every major modern company offers their workers. I myself and my wife, when we had our twins 5 years ago, if we didn't have paid family medical leave from the company that we worked at, I don't know how we would have gotten those kids off to a good start. Now imagine you're a single mom, no supports at all. You work for a small business. They can't put forward their own program. What do you do when a baby comes along? And the answer is you either leave the workforce and you may never get back in it, or you have to beg, borrow, and steal help from a ton of different people to make it happen. That just simply isn't fair. So this is really about the small businesses in our economy who can't afford to put these programs forward themselves. My dad had a small landscaping business growing up, 4 or 5 employees. He never could have created his own paid family medical leave program for 4 or 5 people. It wouldn't make sense. Good news is the House's proposal does this in a really sensible, really common sense way with opt-out provisions for employers, extra help for small employers. This is just an idea whose time has come, and the cost is about the price of a cup of coffee per week per worker. So you could either have, you know, free Starbucks Fridays, or you could offer paid family medical leave to your employees at your business. It's a pretty simple decision if you ask me. And then second, I want to highlight the House's focus on unemployment insurance. We share without reservation the House's perspective that advancing unemployment insurance payments to hourly school workers is long overdue. And just to remind members, eligible UI benefits go to those who have been laid off or put on furlough through no fault of their own. So these are the unemployed who are actively seeking for work, able and willing to work when it's offered. It's not a program that stunts workforce growth, particularly in Minnesota, where we have one of the highest labor force participation rates in the country. It's a program that takes care of workers while they're searching for their next job, but not all workers. If you're a K-12 hourly school worker, you aren't allowed to let the wages you get paid during a school year count towards taking unemployment insurance when you're laid off in the summer if you're not able to find work. And so what this does is it creates kind of a two-tiered system in schools. You've got your salaried teachers and other salaried workers who have UI in the summer. You've got your hourly workers who don't. And in some cases, you've got, you know, food service workers where you'll have a privately employed food service worker working right alongside a K-12 hourly school worker. One of them, at the end of the school year, is going to get UI, and one of them isn't. I mean, that's just not fair, and it doesn't make sense for our economy. I know this issue is important. My mom worked as a paraprofessional in middle schools in Northfield and Rosemont for 20 years, and she worked with autistic children inside the classroom, outside the classroom. She never had the benefit that her fellow teachers did, and it just wasn't fair. My mom since retired, but here's why this is even more important today. These hourly workers taking care of our kids every day, in so many cases, could make a lot more money by quitting the school and heading down the street to work for a Quick Trip. I mean, that's the state of our economy right now. Think about that. Our hourly school workers who take care of our kids, drive our kids' buses, serve our kids' food, our paraprofessionals like my mom was, they can make more selling a candy bar at a gas station than taking care of our kids. So we see this as a workforce issue. It's a retention issue. I'm worried about this fall as these hourly workers contemplate going back to school or taking a better, higher-paying job somewhere else. So at a time of workforce shortages, I think extending UI benefits to these workers is smart economics in addition to being the right thing to do. So thanks for your time on this important work. I know this conference committee has challenging work ahead. Deed's committed to working alongside of you on it all. Let's meet this moment together and empower the growth of the Minnesota economy for everyone. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Commissioner Grove. Members, any questions? I have a couple of questions. I think you, Commissioner, you mentioned that we took care of the outstanding debt in the federal, UI trust fund. I understand there is a small fix that needs to be done. I don't know if you wanted to cover a little bit about that issue that we need to take care of and why it's important.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it was very clear in the legislative intent and discussions around the UI replenishment bill that the desire would be to provide credits to or refunds to employers who overpaid, right? Because we didn't get this done by March 14th, so many employers had already paid. We had to go back and reissue credits, or if you want, issue a refund. Refund means we send you a check in the mail. Literally, we send you a physical check in the mail. However, there's just a couple of wording components of the bill that our colleagues at MMB indeed are concerned make the refund check piece of that not possible. So while the credits is good to go, we've already received hundreds of requests for refunds, as you can imagine. Many businesses want this money now. But the way that this was written does not give us the leeway, we think, to issue those refund checks. It amounts to just a single word change. Both Chair Pratt and Chair Knorr have this in front of them, changing one word from section to article and one word from in to for. That's about how minor this is. Small technical fix, but we just want to get it taken care of so we can make sure that those refund checks can go out to any employer who requests one.
Thank you so much, Commissioner, for that, because we need that clarity, and I'm assuming with the support of this conference committee, we'll be able to adopt that quickly and be able to get those checks out as soon as possible. I know you talked about the hourly school workers. We'll have the discussion with folks who are going to start that testimony. Any further questions for the commissioner? Senator Franz.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Commissioner. I wonder if we might have Marta James from House Research give us a brief description of the unemployment eligibility and just give a little bit of a background there for the conference committee as we go forward with the public testimony. I wonder if that might be helpful for the conferees.
Thank you so much. Ms. James, if you can give us just a highlight, an overview of what are the requirements for the eligibility.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members and Senator. So I'll just do this off the top of my head, but I think there are others from DEED might be able to speak more specifically. So to qualify for UI, you have to have a certain number of wage credits. You also have to be unemployed through no fault of your own. UI is a weekly benefit, and so each week that you're applying for UI, you also have to showing that you are seeking employment. And then there are specific categories or specific types of positions that may not qualify. So for example, one of those is the hourly school workers and there's some others in statute as well. So those are just high level requirements. And I'm sorry, I don't recall the wage credit minimum, but it's not a huge amount.
Senator Franz.
Thank you again. Thanks, Ms. James, and thanks, Mr. Chair. Just making sure that Minnesotans watching this discussion keep in mind the searching for employment component of the eligibility. I think that's something that we heard about during the pandemic and glad to have it covered by Ms. James. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Suzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a follow-up to Senator Franz's question, maybe to the commissioner or to others, because of the drastic nature of the 200,000 job openings that we do have in the state, we do have a requirement that folks are continually searching for work. And one of the complaints that I've heard from employers was that, you know, we're offering folks jobs, but they're not taking the job. And so they're filling out the requirements of unemployment, but not really the spirit of unemployment. And wanted to get members' thoughts on that, the commissioner's thoughts on, you know, if there would be some room, even if on a temporary basis, to maybe make some changes that if someone is offered a job, that they would rejoin and not just simply be able to turn that job down or not show up or whatever that might be. Thank you.
I think just to address, I'll give it to the commissioner. Our unemployment rate is less than even 2.5%, one of the lowest in many years. So that means everyone who's looking for a job will likely be finding a job and they'll be working in the workforce. But there are so many folks who left the labor force completely. Those are not being counted in the data. And I think there's an excellent dashboard through DEED that you can follow where we need help and everything else. To Commissioner Grove, if you wanted to expound on that issue.
Sure. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative, it's an important question. And you're right that you have to be able, actively searching for a job to be qualifying for unemployment insurance. And if you get a job offer, you have to take it. if it's suitable employment. But the symptom of getting a job and not taking it is the symptom of a tight labor market. That very same person could be off taking another job that has higher payer benefits somewhere else. And so the challenge we have right now is there's about 2.7 open jobs in our state for every one person looking for a job. And so unfortunately, roughly two out of every three employers is going to come up disappointed when offering a job to someone that doesn't take one. Minnesota has one of the highest, and has for a long time, labor force participation rates in the country, which is to say people here work hard. It's not just sort of a Midwestern anecdote. It's actually true. People here do work harder than most places. And when you look at the data between states, for example, that cut off the extended unemployment insurance benefits last summer earlier than others, there's been no evidence that that, in fact, hastened a return to work by workers in those states that cut those benefits off. So these are somewhat philosophical issues, but the data seems to bear out that we want to make sure people get back into the job market quickly. I can tell you that thousands of people every week are getting off unemployment insurance in Minnesota and back into the workforce, and that's reflected in some of the data that we just talked about. So it's a really important question, one that every employer is grappling with. I hear the same things you do, by the way, so it's challenging. But again, I think this issue, getting it back to hourly workers, is one of fairness. Many of them, we hope, will and do find summer employment, but not having that available simply because you're an hourly worker seems to be a really odd quirk of our system and something that should be fixed.
Thank you, Commissioner. Just to give you a perspective, this morning, my son did not have a school bus driver to pick him up to take him to school. We had to drive him to school. The workforce shortage in school bus driver is real, and with no assurance that they will be able to find a job, competing with so many young people during the summer, and also not assurance that they can come back to the same job, isn't helpful. So they're finding different other jobs. So school districts are struggling as I speak to you today. So that will be the next conversation if we don't have any further question for the commissioner. Chair Singer.
I had a comment to make. I think I'll just save it personally for the commissioner.
Okay.
Thank you. Commissioner, Chair Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Grove, if I recall, when the governor required schools to close, bus drivers, hourly workers all collected unemployment, correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe that, so there were some special federal provisions for unemployment insurance at the time, and they covered such things as sole proprietors and those who aren't usually covered in the system. So school bus drivers got something called pandemic unemployment insurance. So it was the same that went to sort of an Uber driver or a sole proprietor. So they were covered by a federal program, but it was not the governor who came in to pay them those summer benefits. It was the PUA program from the federal government.
Chair Brent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm reflecting maybe on previous discussions. I can't remember with you or anybody else, but it's my understanding that when school bus drivers and hourly workers were laid off during the school year, they qualified for unemployment insurance because they were unable to work during the period of the contract. Many of these school bus drivers, hourly workers, are working on seasonal contracts where the teachers are on 12-month contracts. And to me, that seems to be the main difference between the two. And so to say that these people don't have access to unemployment, they're just being treated like other seasonal workers, whether they be working at Valley Fair in my district or other places. And so I think we have to have this conversation in the right context. And I just wanted to clarify that they do, in fact, qualify for unemployment when they are laid off during their contract period. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could respond to that just briefly. You're right that during the school year, you're eligible for unemployment insurance. I don't know many bus drivers or hourly school workers who are being laid off right now given the workforce shortages, so I don't think that's really the issue that's at the heart of this. Again, salaried workers can get paid throughout the year. I'm sure we all have family members who are teachers. You can get paid through the summer through that paycheck. Hourly workers don't. And I think that you'll hear from advocates in a bit, I'm sure, but school workers are, I think, a particularly essential piece of the workforce puzzle in our state, as we all know. And I think that gap in this system has been longstanding, and it's challenging. These workers are treated differently than construction workers who are laid off in the winter, for example. So I think there is a real fairness issue here at the core of this, and would urge us to consider moving forward on it.
See no further questions. Commissioner, closing remarks.
Well, just thank you all. We're looking forward to working with everybody here. A lot to discuss, good debate, and nobody better to do it than this committee. So thank you all, and looking forward to the testifiers to follow.
Thank you so much, Commissioner Grove. So with that, we, I think because we talked about the UI hourly school workers, we need to understand the issue properly. So we'll start with Bill Arimbogo, if I admit that's correct. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chairs Noor, Pratt, and committee members. My name is Bill Arimbogo, and I am the union president, ESP union president in the Morris School District. Education support professionals support our schools in many different roles. They are the paraprofessionals assisting education, special education students, the nutrition food service workers keeping our kids fed, the administrative clerks helping guide the school day, and they are much more. As we have seen all over, we too are facing a staffing crisis in the Morris School District. Just this year, we've lost over 13 ESPs and have several positions that need to be filled. One of the ongoing struggles that hourly workers face is the lack of work in the summer and the inability to draw unemployment insurance while looking for work during this time. The district used to provide year-round pay option to hourly workers, but they stopped that option, and now many face difficult options of finding temporary summer work, or they find themselves leaving the profession they love entirely for a more consistent and often better paying work. Aside from ESPs being the lowest paid in the schools, the absence of this benefit harms some hourly workers more than others. For instance, clerical ESPs in Mora have an even shorter window of time that they can be doing temporary summer work before needing to return to their job in the district, expecting them to easily find other suitable work for just 5 weeks is not sustainable. I would like to remind the committee that this concept isn't an unrealistic expectation. Many other seasonal workers have this benefit, including private subcontractors who come into schools and do the exact same work as hourly school employees. We are asking that you make this right by granting school workers equal protections so that we can continue doing the work that we love, providing students with the high quality support that they need to flourish. So please consider adding this provision to your final compromise. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Please stand by just in case of any questions. The next person on this topic is Kat Briggs. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Noor, Chair Pratt, and committee members. My name is Kat Briggs, and I'm a school bus driver for Independent School District 196 and a member of SEIU Local 284. Before I start, I want to thank Emma Greenman and my union brother, Jason Rarick, for authoring the bill. I deeply appreciate your support. I was a fortunate kid in Oregon in that I had the same school bus driver from grade school through the end of high school. Peggy, bus 39. She knew my name, where I lived. She took me to and from school every day, as well as all of my field trips and after school events. She even looped through the neighborhood for me a few times when I missed the bus. I hope I make the same impact for my students. Before the pandemic, bus drivers and chaperones suffered through the summer with reduced hours and small paychecks. Currently, the summer months, school routes are 4 hours a day, 16 hours a week, for approximately 6 weeks. This is not enough to sustain a household. Hopefully, you remember my coworker, Teresa
and I'll say her name right, Jakubowski. She testified before this conference committee a year ago. She was considering leaving her position as a bus driver, and indeed she has. She, like myself, has had to deal with the uncertainty of summer employment and the inability to be able to provide for her family. Her decision was a loss to our transportation department, and she will be and is missed. My other half works on a farm. My first year as a school bus driver was a tough weather year, and we nearly lost our home. No one told me that I would not be eligible for unemployment during the summer months. This year, by driving extended routes, extra routes, and charters, I was able to save money to help get us through the summer months. But a cancer diagnosis took that away from me. Those months of savings have been wiped out during my recovery, and summer will be tough again. My sons are both concrete workers. They get unemployment compensation during winter months when it's too cold to pour concrete. They've done it in this building. I, too, should have the same basic economic security when there is no school. Each summer since the beginning of the pandemic and even before, there has been a mass exodus of school employees across the state, especially bus drivers. Currently, ISD 196 is down 16 drivers and 2 chaperones. Additionally, 6 more drivers have submitted their tentative notice to leave by the end of the school year. Even with new driver chaperone recruitment, we will be at a deficit, and that will increase to new levels at the beginning of the next school year. These inexperienced drivers and chaperones have no idea of the financial hardship that the summer months can bring. They are about to hit a wall in June. Without partial wage replacement, they will take their CDLs down the road and never come back. There is no end in sight for the school staffing crisis in this state. Unemployment insurance will help with the retention and training to ensure that we have the best people to transport, nurture, and care for our and your precious children and grandchildren to and from school. I love my kids. When they're on my bus, they're my kids. I watch them grow and flourish. They transform from shy new kindergartners to warm, happy, social first graders with their first exposure to education in Minnesota taking place on my bus. The task of changing the UI law has been going on for years. You, the legislature of the state of Minnesota, Democrat and Republican, are so close to making a profound change to the lives of every hourly school wage employee by correcting the UI law. So close to providing economic security for those who change the lives of your children and your children's children. Let's get this done. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Briggs, for your testimony and sharing your story with us. We really appreciate you and wish you all the best in everything that you have done for all of us.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have the next person on the list is Jake Canop. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Sure. Great. Thank you. Good afternoon, committee members. Thank you, Chair Pratt and Noor, for the opportunity to share my testimony today. First off, to Ms. Briggs, thank you for your service, and certainly be thinking of you and wishing you the best. My name is Jake Carnop. I'm a school board member in ISD 14, which is in Fridley. Of note, we are the only district in the state of Minnesota that has an IB district from pre-K to 12th grade. And my testimony is certainly in support of the unemployment benefits for our hourly school employees. In my day job, I'm an employee with the United States Postal Service as a letter carrier. I've been doing that for about 24 years. Of those 24 years, the last 12 I've spent working for my union, the National Association of Letter Carriers. I bring up my work history to you as a person that really has never had to worry about job security or unemployment. I guess our motto Neither snow, rain, heat, nor gloom of night stays these couriers from their swift completion of their appointed rounds. Has its advantages. Don't try to tell a letter carrier that when it's 30 below, but certainly we benefit from year-round employment. While job security has not been a personal concern in my personal life, it certainly is a concern for me as a school board member in Fridley. And I stand before you today in support of our hourly school employees that do not have the same security as a letter carrier or any other non-school employee in our state. As you are aware, our paraeducators, our bus drivers, our food service, clerical, and maintenance workers are paid by the hour. When the school season ends, many of these employees must find employment for the 2 to 3 months during the summer. If these employers are unable to find employment, they do not have the same ability to file for unemployment insurance as our other employees in our state. I'm not quite sure if you all can hear this, but my neighbor is cutting a tree down, and she's not doing it herself. She's hired a company. And sitting here listening to some of this testimony, I have a bird's eye view of the work that's going on out there. And it's not lost on me that those workers out there right now, that if they find themselves out of work this winter, they have more protections and safety nets for unemployment insurance than the men and women that drove our kids to school this morning. They have more benefits and protections than the men and women that served our kids lunch today. And they certainly have more protections than our paraeducators that are supporting our students and staff. That is not lost on me, and I certainly hope it's not lost on you. We've heard some testimony today already about the job market. Here in Fridley, we are certainly no different. A day does not go by where we are not looking for hourly employees. We have the same struggles as everyone else. I don't need to regurgitate those. But with that said, I would certainly like to point something out. I believe Commissioner Grove talked about, why not just go down to the Quick Trip where you can make more money and work year round? Well, in Fridley, we have a Target, and that Target building and store is about 2 miles from our high school. And if an employee would like to go to work for Target, their starting salary is anywhere between $15 and $24 an hour for year-round employment, very likely. If you want to work in our district, you can expect to start as an hourly wage worker anywhere between $15 and $16, depending on the job and your experience. Now, while our hourly employees may make a little bit more than the starting wage at Target, there is a big difference in these two types of jobs from a perspective of a potential employee, at least in my mind. For instance, the Target job would be year-round employment. For these school jobs, hourly jobs are not. If a Target employee gets laid off, they have the security of unemployment insurance benefits if needed. However, when a Fridley employee is unemployed at the end of the school year, they do not have that same security. Clearly, Target or any other employee in our state would offer more security than our hourly school employees. Now, from personal experience and talking to some of our hourly employees, most of our school employees, by virtue of the jobs they work, must find alternate employment in the summer. And that's okay, it happens. As a matter of fact, I was talking to one of our paraeducators that's the crossing guard for my son, and I asked her her summer plans this year, and she said she's already got 2 or 3 jobs lined up. And that's okay too. But what if the job market takes a turn? And what if those 2 to 3 jobs disappear? What is she left with? She's certainly not left with the same protections as the employees across the street from me that are cutting down trees. And I think that needs to be addressed. Now, with that said, I fully anticipate that many of our hourly school employees have and will continue to find summer employment. And if that's the case, they will not be entitled to unemployment benefits. I also anticipate that some of our hourly school employees may just take the summer off and enjoy time with their family and friends, and maybe just recharge their batteries. And if that's the case, they will certainly not be entitled to unemployment benefits. However, this bill will provide a safety net for those hourly school employees that find themselves unemployed at the end of the year and are unable to find other employment until the beginning of the next year. This protection is no different than the unemployment safety net provided to any other employee in our state, from my perspective. And I urge you to honor our school employees with the same safety nets as those other employees. And the only thing that I would like to note, and I would certainly be open to questions, to Commissioner Arnold, if she's still around, you'd be happy to know that Fridley has got about five buildings that have solar panels on them, and we're getting close to finishing our last one, and hopefully we'll be on that course of being self-sufficient. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Director Canop. We really appreciate the work that you do. You know, Chair Pratt and I both have served on the school board, so we understand the challenges that school districts are going through with this process. So thank you so much for your service and also your testimony. The next person on the list is Jennifer Irwin. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Pratt, Chair Noor, and members of the conference committee for hearing my testimony today. For the record, my name is Jennifer Irwin. I'm first vice president of AFSCME Local 4001, but I'm here today as a mother of a young man that needed the care and compassion of the staff at Stuartville Public Schools. It is long past time that school workers have the same access to unemployment insurance as just about every other worker in Minnesota. Let me tell you a little bit about how important it was for my son to have the supports he needed. My son has autism, and he needed para support throughout his entire school life. In second or third grade, he had a para who he really connected with and still remembers to this day. The para cared about and took an interest in my son, and their relationship was so much better because of it. We had a notebook we would transfer back and forth, notes about his school day and time at home. If he hadn't slept well or had a bad day at school, we knew about it and worked together to make a better day for my son and try again the next day. But when I asked to also know the good things, the para would write down those too. So many times, parents and the students only hear when things are off the rails or not going the right way. We need to hear that things are also good, and this para took the time to do that for us. Paras are not in their positions to get rich by any means. It's because they have a passion for special education and helping students to be the most successful they can. Often, though, we lose these employees to a job if they have to get, or excuse me, job they have to get during the summer to make it possible to pay their bills. I implore you to extend unemployment insurance to those workers in our schools. I'd also be remiss if I didn't ask that you extend UI to my coworkers in our colleges and universities as well. Lots of my coworkers are in exactly the same situation as the others that have testified here, where they are stuck finding second and third jobs every year to make ends meet. Every time we force them to do that, we run the risk of losing really great, talented people at our CTC, the college where I work. These workers just deserve UI as well, and I hope that we can make UI a possibility for all workers. Again, thank you for hearing my testimony today, and please include the expansion of UI to hourly school workers in your ominous bill.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Do you have the name?
Go ahead.
I do have Dave Camper online. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chairs Noor, Pratt, and members of the committee. My name is Dave Camper, and I live in Brooklyn Park in the new 34B, but I work as a senior state policy coordinator for the Economic Policy Institute, which is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization in D.C. that analyzes how the economy is performing for ordinary working people and develops policies that will improve working families' economic outcomes. I'm going to share my screen to show some slides, which have also been shared with the committee administrators. All right, can people see the presentation?
Yes, we can see.
Outstanding, thank you so very much. My task today is to describe the work we've done on between-term unemployment insurance benefits for non-licensed school staff. I will say no one has ever accused me in my entire life of speaking too slowly, so if I'm going too quick, don't hesitate to stop me. I also tested positive for COVID this morning, so anything I say that's a mistake is because of COVID. Okay, just making that clear. The research I'm presenting today is from a piece my colleague Julia Wolf and I did last spring with updated numbers from EPI's economic indicators. We were able to do this research because Illinois tried effectively the same thing that's in this bill in the summer of 2000, and the Illinois Department of Economic Security was able to produce an analysis of the impact. We compared the characteristics of Illinois' non-licensed school staff to Minnesota's to arrive at estimates of what it would mean for this state. We found it would be a good policy because it would provide targeted relief to a sector of workers who really need it at a cost that school districts can reasonably bear. Let me start with who we're talking about. And if I move through these charts too quickly, please do let me know. And as I say, the charts have been shared with you. As you can see, women constitute an overwhelming majority of non-licensed school staff, and Black and Hispanic workers are more likely to be employed in this group than the overall workforce. In addition, school support staff tend, on average, to be older than the average worker in the country. Median wages, weekly wages for school support staff are low, partly because of the low hourly pay rates, and partly because they often work fewer hours. If you look, for example, at bus drivers in this slide, their hourly rate of pay is 20% less than a typical worker's, but their weekly pay is 40% less than a typical worker's because of the shorter hours they work. And this helps explain why so many of them are leaving their jobs. This data is specific from school jobs, and you can see significant declines. I've heard bus drivers come up several times. You can tell why. Bus drivers are particularly well hit by this. And before I go further, I want to address briefly the concept of the Great Resignation, as it's called. I didn't make a slide for this, but I want to speak to it. It is indeed true that the rate at which people are leaving their jobs has been higher in the past year than it's ever been since we've been recording the data. This, however, is not because workers are leaving the workforce. What's happening is that people, and this is a good thing, people are finding better opportunities that either offer them better pay or better working conditions or other things, and are moving to those jobs. And so we prefer great reallocation to great resignation. This does not mean that schools are losing staff to better, this does also mean, however, that schools are losing staff to better paying opportunities. Raising school employee pay and adding eligibility for unemployment in the summer will help districts deal with staffing shortages by reducing the chance an employee will find another job. So how do you calculate what this will benefit, how much it will cost? It's not a super easy question. And the main question is one of recipiency. And just to be clear on the term, recipiency means of the people who are theoretically eligible for a benefit, how many will actually take that benefit? And in the pre-pandemic years, 2015 to 2019, Minnesota's pre-pandemic recipiency rate was 39 to 45%. We are one of the highest in the country for recipiency, and I think that probably reflects great credit on the hardworking people who work for the state's unemployment system. And I don't just say that because I worked for MAPE until a couple of years ago. They're good people doing good work. But of course, when it comes to school support staff, some are already employed by the school district 12 months a year, and therefore wouldn't come up for unemployment. And some number already have another job lined up. And as was discussed previously before we got here, people cannot just decide to quit a job they already had lined up in order to collect unemployment. So how can you calculate recipiency? And before I go to that, I want to put in a quick reminder here, because I know that the legislature dealt with the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund this cycle. School districts, like other public employers in Minnesota, directly reimburse actual costs to the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. So extending unemployment insurance benefits to school support staff will not result in any changes in how unemployment taxes are calculated for other employers in the private sector. If a school district pays unemployment to someone, they just pay that money directly back into the trust fund. But because it's so difficult to figure out recipients, the fact that we have a comparator state is really so valuable because it allows us to look at real data rather than trying to guess.
Mr. Chair.
Now, Illinois enacted summer
Mr. Chair,
unemployment
excuse
insurance.
Me. Mr. Chair, I think this is interesting and something that
you know, we could follow up on if the testifier wants to submit his presentation, but I'm wondering how long we're going to be going on this one item with a long list of testifiers yet to go.
Mr. Chair, I think we will be done before 4. So in case we don't get to all the testifiers, I apologize ahead of time. I wanted to make sure that Dave Kempa and also Tiffany Gerstin will be the last on this issue, and we'll have a little bit of conversation. So I just wanted to ask Mr. Kempa to speed up the testimony. I don't know how long he has on this slide.
Thank you, chairs and committee members. I will move as quickly as I can. So we took the evidence from Illinois, and in Illinois, 11% of eligible or of school support staff total applied for this unemployment benefit. And in the piece I said, we go through our math there. What does this mean for Minnesota? If the numbers hold for Minnesota, it means that about 6,800 employees would collect 11 weeks of benefits averaging $4,058. That's a significant sum to underpaid school support staff. And again, you've got the slides, so I won't spend time on this. I want to move quickly. We also want to look at how the cost would be spread. That weekly benefit would count to about $28 million, and that would amount to about 1.1% of school districts' total reserves at the end of 2020. As such, this is a benefit that will help people who really need it and will do so in a financially sustainable manner. I thank you very much, and I'll end quickly now so you can move on.
Thank you so much for your testimony, and in case of any questions, please stand by Mr. Kempa. So if you needed the slides, it's online. So the next person to testify on this issue is Tiffany Gerstin. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, thank you. My name is Tiffany Gerstin. I'm the Associate Director of Management and Insurance Trust Services with the Minnesota School Boards Association. To the chairs and conferees, thank you so much for your time and attention today and the opportunity to testify. First of all, I would like to acknowledge the points and the stories of the previous testifiers. I don't think that there is anyone in this call, in the room, or online who would argue that the hourly employees that we are talking about today have stepped up to the plate during an extremely difficult time before the pandemic, but certainly over the last couple of years as school districts have dealt with changing learning models and stressful situations. And certainly in the cases where school districts were asked to provide childcare for emergency workers, there were employees who stepped up to the plate and did things that weren't in their normal job description, and these employees are to be commended. However, school districts must carefully balance their needs with the needs of students, parents, community members, taxpayers, and all while managing a strict budget. Minnesota Statute 268.085, Subdivision 7, exempts all school employees, including teachers, who have a reasonable assurance of employment in the fall. So what that means is if a school employee, whether hourly or salaried in the case of our teachers, ends this one school year and has a reasonable assurance of being brought back in the fall for continued employment, those employees are not eligible for unemployment. The proposed changes would not change that for our teaching staff. However, it would provide those wage credits for our hourly employees, as has been talked about by other testifiers. So if our teachers, for example, have a license through PELSBY, or our administrators are licensed through the Board of School Administrators, they would still not be eligible for unemployment benefits under the proposed language. So as the wife of a seasonal employee of the state of Minnesota, I have given a lot of thought to why my stance on it's okay for him to collect unemployment, however, it's different for our school employees, and I believe that the difference lies in the funding streams. As a former school business official, my role was to be responsible with and be a responsible steward of the school district resources, balancing that fiscal responsibility with the goal of maximizing student achievement. Commissioner Robertson mentioned the benefits of the proposed changes related to recruitment and retention. However, those challenges could also be dealt with through other means, including one of the highest priority items of several of the statewide educational groups, and that would be dealing with the special education cross-subsidy. Eliminating that cross-subsidy would allow school districts the flexibility to increase the wages and the benefits of these hourly employees to recruit and retain, but while also hitting our goal of maintaining and increasing student achievement. We acknowledge and appreciate the proposed funding that will establish the reimbursement account for these costs in the short term. However, when they are exhausted, there will be an increase to local property taxes as school districts' option to pay for the costs will be to add these expenses to the levy. Just to give you an idea, if the state of Minnesota wants to add an additional highway patrol or wants to purchase an additional snowplow, it has the ability to increase its revenue stream through a variety of different ways, including an increase to income taxes. If a county wants to hire an additional health and human services staff, it can do so by increasing its levy. These organizations can levy or tax based on their budget. However, school districts are different. Our levy is set by funding formula, largely set through general education aid through the legislature, and those revenues are set. We must budget based on our levy and other revenue streams. As I plugged in some comparatives to see what this language would do for school districts, I used four districts from across the state. We took their hourly salaries and compared the possible population of people who would qualify for this unemployment under the proposed language. And the increase to the levy, again, once these funds are to reimburse the school districts are gone, would increase the levy somewhere between 3.83 and 11.82%. Again, an increase to the local property tax levy for these particular school districts. Again, this is going to be in the out years once this funding is gone. However, the concern from the School Boards Association is in the event that those funds run out and those dollars are assessed to the levy, according to that unemployment levy opportunity, is that it would hinder taxpayers' ability to support operating and bond referendums. So if we lose operating referendums and bond referendums in our schools because of a taxpayer's inability to pay due to this unemployment levy, we're going to affect classrooms, we're going to affect these very hourly employees who would benefit in the short term for unemployment, and we would affect the educational facilities in which we teach. If the language were to pass, tax dollars could be spent, in effect, to pay school employees not to work. As we have talked about the proposed legislation with superintendent groups across the state, superintendents have raised some frustration about the language. One stating, with the increase in federal dollars that have come to school districts, and specifically one bucket for summer programming, they are already having a difficult time finding staff who would like to work in these summer programs. Providing these funds, these unemployment funds, could exacerbate those struggles. Instead, the superintendents would like to have these, instead of having the employees laid off for the summer, the superintendents would like to instead use the dollars to create programs and to add educational opportunities for students. However, we can't levy for that. So the levy opportunity that school districts have at this point is to levy for unemployment, to levy dollars to not provide programs for students, where we are not able to levy programs or levy funds to provide students with programs. Again, I want to circle back. I don't want to speak against the proposed legislation. If I look at the individuals, if I put on the hat of a bus driver or a paraprofessional, and I think previous testifiers have done a wonderful job of bringing that perspective to light. However, I often refer to when I was a school district business manager of running a school as much like running a marathon. And I think with mandates, including this, the paying of unemployment, is that we're expecting our school leaders to run this marathon, but we're going to expect them to do it with a sprained ankle, with the inability to use the resources and to use those dollars in the best way to help our students. There are concerns from school districts, and again, I think that the point was made about suitable employment and those jobs being available. However, with negotiating separate contracts, in many cases with different unions, there's concerns from school districts about employees crossing over between the different contracts. In some schools, those employees are covered under one agreement. So there is a lot of concern on how this would be implemented. However, again, the primary concern is just the funding stream and the financial ability for school districts to levy these dollars and the impact that it will have on a referendum and just the cost and the ability to retain and attract employees. So with that, I will stand for questions for the sake of time. Thank you so much for your time and attention.
Thank you so much, Ms. Gustin, for your testimony and also giving us a different perspective. So just wanted to let members know that this is Article 5 in the House bill, and that's what we've been discussing so far, the hourly school workers. So any discussion, members? Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Chair Noor. I, for sake of time, I'm not going to ask any questions, but I think our last testifier really brought out a lot of the concerns I have. And it is, this is something, I'm the chief author of the bill in the Senate. It's something I really want to see what we can do. But the issue of funding is the piece that's holding it up. You know, last year we had the piece for 16 and 17-year-olds and people who get Social Security. Their employers were paying into the system for them. That's not happening with the school workers, and that becomes, that's the part that we have to, if we're going to do this, we have to figure out. When we look at the numbers and the slides that were put up, in Illinois, it sure sounds like the schools paid that in, and the slides showed that it would be a cost to the school districts. The superintendents I have spoken to about this, and I think was illustrated very well, that is their issue. They are already tight on their budgets. I know in the proposal we have it that we're going to start with state funding, but what other employer can then come forward and say, well, why do not my employees get their UI benefits paid for by state funding? It's a tough slope to go down, and the examples being used, you know, the people who are cutting the trees or pouring concrete, their employers pay in on UI, and in these seasonals, their employers pay in at a rate higher than anybody else. That's their experience rating. So that those are all things that, I mean, we really have to engage a whole lot more with the school districts and with the general public to see how they're willing to pay for this if we're going to add school workers into UI. I don't think we have that understanding and agreement in place yet. So thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair Rick. You raised more questions than answers. I'll be following up. I just wanted to give Senator Frantz an opportunity to ask.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Rarick. First of all, thanks for being the author of the bill. You're exactly right. We got some stuff to talk about. I guess my sensitivity here is it's a category of employee that's very important, and we're at threat of losing them. So I think it's totally fair for you to raise the funding question, and you should count on us to engage to try to figure it out. One of the examples that we're given is food service workers. Those that are privately contracted, eligible for unemployment, to your point, their employers kick in. They work right alongside district employees who are not eligible. And my concern is that's a category where we're now seeing a difficulty recruiting and retaining. And so I appreciate you raising those issues. Again, count on engagement from us, but it's certainly an area where these employees are asking, you know, do you want us to come back? And I can't resist quoting the testifier who said they're going to take their CDLs down the road and not come back. I know that's on us, too, to try to figure out a solution. Stay tuned. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Frantz. And I think to that question, Chair Rarick, you raised a good question. If you are an employee for the school district, you are being treated differently. So I'll give you an example. If you're a school bus driver today working for the school district, for example, in Minneapolis, more than 75% are contracted as I speak right now because they cannot find enough workforce. But none of them, the employers are paying into the UI Trust Fund. And I just wanted to get that clarity in. We're not treating equally because the equal treatment does not exist in the system. So to that end, should those employees who are working for independent contractors, school bus drivers who are paying into the trust fund, should they qualify for an employment benefit?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, it's... If they are being paid in for, my position would be that they're eligible for the UI benefits. That's where I've been. It is, but and for the contracts, they are being paid in for. So I think our big question is those who are employed by the school districts, it is my understanding that this was put in place the way it is many, many years back to help save our school districts money. And so that is our big question. How do we deal with that piece and not put our schools in a really, really bad financial situation?
Thank you, Chair Eric. That's the exact issue that we're trying to solve here, Chair Eric. I think you can understand when many of the employers are hiring independent contractors so they can meet their obligation, and none of them are eligible because that small group of food service workers, which we give them a carve-out, if you're working for a private company today and doing a food service for the school district, you qualify. We treat you different than a worker who works for the school district who we're telling them you don't qualify, you don't deserve that financial security. And mostly of them are women. Let me be quite honest. Women who are serving in our school districts are being left out. That pay equity exists in many places. And when you look on the flip side, seasonal workers who are mostly men are getting paid for unemployment. So we got to fix that equity issue when it comes to paying women what they have worked for. They have earned it. They deserve it. We should be able to give them their pay. Any further questions? Chair Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You know, what we're talking about is people who sign up for nine-month contracts of employment, and they know the terms going into their job. I mean, we've passed legislation to say they have to know what they make and what the terms of their employment are before they start. And we're comparing these folks to, you know, construction workers, and I've talked to some of the trades, and many of these construction workers aren't sitting out over the winter. Most of them are you know, out on different jobs. But maybe the question is it that the school workers are being treated differently, or is it that maybe the people that we're paying unemployment to who have seasonal contracts, and I don't believe they do have seasonal contracts. I think the difference here is that we're talking about even the construction workers have 12-month contracts, I believe, and they're laid off and they go back to work as soon as the weather permits. Which is very different than a set schedule that we're dealing with now. And you want to talk? I mean, where does this, you know, where does this end? You know, I mentioned Valley Fair, or you know, Senator Dreheim has seasonal workers. And what happens at the end of the summer when those people go back to college or back to other jobs? Are we expected to pay unemployment for all of those? This becomes a very slippery slope, Mr. Chair. And when we talk about equity, I think we've got to talk about what are the terms of employment when this person takes that job. And I wasn't going to weigh in on this at this point in time, but I'm concerned with the tone and the tenor that this conversation has taken.
Thank you, Chair Pratt. I think it's not the tone and tenor. It's because of what we've seen during the pandemic. A whole list of folks have been left out from the financial security. We wanted to make sure that if they need and they deserve to be receiving that employment, this is the right conversation for us, you know, to discuss, because it's in Article 5. And part of the conversation is where can we reach a consensus when it comes to the reasonable assurance, whether it's written or, you know, just agreed to. That reasonable assurance does not give the employee or the worker at the school that they will have a job. That being told that you will be coming back, whether it's written or unwritten, then you are ineligible for the unemployment benefit. For that reason, I think we got to address this issue and find a better way to address whether to serve them. So I see Chair Pratt, and also see Senator Franz, if you wanted to add anything.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Pratt. I mean, you're on the right issue, which is how are we going to pay for this? I hope that we keep in mind, though, that we have a constitutional duty to provide for education. It's a little different than Valley Fair in that that's private enterprise, but I'm totally with you that it's important. And I think to Chair Noor's point, these are the lowest paid workers, and we're going to run out of them if we don't do something. And while I don't have all the answers for Senator Rarick, I think the discussion here should be a good one. Let's, you know, put our heads together and see what we can find out. If we stop having bus drivers, we're going to have a whole different kind of problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Pratt.
Chair Pratt.
Just one last comment. And Senator Franz, I'm not talking about the cost. I'm talking about what we hire people to do. And you know, if you have a nine-month contract, and as we heard today, when these employees were laid off during the school year, they were able to collect unemployment. This is about the time Why are we paying unemployment at a point in time when they're not under contract to work? That's the question. Just and to me, that becomes the same question as the Valley Fair employee or the resort employee or you know, name your seasonal. Could be Buck Hill and the ski lift operator, right? That's what we're talking about. It's not about necessarily, I mean, Sarah Rarick talked about the pay, and that's extremely important. But I think we have a kind of a philosophical slippery slope here, so to speak. And I don't know why these school, you know, why wouldn't these employees be under 12-month contract? If that's the intent, then that's what school districts should be negotiating. That's what their bargaining units should be negotiating. That's not for us to step in and say, we're going to supersede a seasonal contract in that way. So I, you know, thank you for that, but that wasn't my argument.
Thank you, Chair Pratt. I think you mentioned one important aspect of this issue. If you're working, a seasonal worker working for any other place, you do qualify because the employer is already paying into the unemployment trust fund. So this is a small particular group that we decided to exclude them. And I think that's the conversation that we're having here today. And the other aspects of many other things that we need to be solving is the obligation that we have. When we fund our school district, we need to fully fund them based on the need that exists. And this should help us because schools are, you know, just like the state, we are considered to be reimbursing employers. So if that is our obligation to fund our school district, if it's our obligation to fund our schools, if it's our obligation to make sure that our kids get the best education, as we know the working conditions of those workers are the learning conditions for our kids. So we can make that investment to make sure that they're able to provide the necessary help. When you have got a para serving or helping the teacher, then you're able to serve that school district and the school system. So I understand we need to find the balance, and that's the conversation we need to have by bringing this positioning and making sure that we take care of those hourly school workers, particularly those who are, you know, lowest wage earners. I can tell you, my own school district, they were trying to fight to be funded well during the last strike that you have seen. They were getting paid $24,000. Tell me who's going to stay getting the lowest, the least amount of income. They'll find another job. So we're trying to make sure we provide the financial security. Just like any other employer, just like anyone else in the state of Minnesota, they also deserve to be included. And it has been more than 80 years that we have left them out. They deserve to be included in the UI. And that's the position we are in the House, and we are asking the conferees from the Senate to join us so we can solve this issue once and for all. Any further discussions on this issue? So, Chair Senju.
This is an educational moment for me, but so we have some school districts and probably many actually that have private bus carriers and private food service workers. Are we talking about subsidizing their UI through their private business? Is that what we're talking about? In some cases, at least.
Well, to the one of the situations that we're talking about, if you are a food service worker working in the school district for a private employer, so that employer has got a contract with the district, that individual qualifies for that employment. And they're paid by the school district, by the way. The funds come from the school district. The funds that we give them or the resource that they have is what pays for that employer. And their employees are eligible to receive an employment. But if on the same side, somebody who's working side by side with that food service worker is employed by the school district, they do not qualify for the unemployment benefit. So there's an equal treatment that we created within the law in the state of Minnesota. So we're trying to solve some of those unequal treatment that exist in our system and say everybody should be treated fairly and should deserve that financial security. And when it comes to employment, we do have more than 200,000 jobs, and I'm sure that everybody will be finding a better job than getting paid a small amount of $400 a week, which doesn't even pay enough to pay for their rent and everything else. So this is just for financial security to make sure that if they cannot find that employment, then they've got an option to be able to apply for. And there's also a waiting week. You don't just immediately receive that employment. You have to show that you're able and willing to work in order to qualify, as you've had from the House nonpartisan staff. So many things that we need to solve, but at least we wanted to highlight this critical issue. Thank you, everyone, I think, for listening, and I want to thank the testifiers. So we move to Article 3 and 4 in the House position, which is the paid family medical leave. We have got few testifiers on this issue, and I'll ask them to keep it brief for at least 2 minutes or three as possible. So Shannon Burns, welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hello, Chair Knorr, Chair Pratt, and members. My name is Shannon Burns. I am a member of the Main Street Alliance, an entrepreneur in Alexandria, and own Dunord, an exclusive small business consultancy in the West Central region of Minnesota and across the state. The pandemic has been a roller coaster for myself and the small business owners I work with. Every single small business that I work with has had to be without members of their staff for weeks at a time, sometimes more than once in the last couple of years, and it's only put them even further behind. Luckily, the federal government provided businesses with a limited amount of paid medical time off in 2021 through the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, allowing businesses to pay their staff while they had to be off because they had to quarantine or care for a loved one. Being able to provide this type of benefit was a first for most small businesses in Alexandria and other areas of greater Minnesota, one that should not end with the pandemic. As an individual mom and pop business owner, I lack the support system that many people in the corporate world have. In 2015, I left my consultancy aside and got a job with a major nationally recognized business 90 miles away from my home, making a wage half of what I was making as a self-employed person. The post-recession job market was still tough. I have an MBA and had 10 years of corporate experience prior to that time. The only reason I did this was with the hope that I would be able to have some sort of maternity leave with my baby. At 8 months pregnant, I was tired, and 2 months later, I gave birth to my beautiful child. My paid leave was for 6 weeks and only a small portion of my take-home pay. I know I'm not the only one whose story mirrors mine. I stayed with that job, driving the distance each day, pumping on the interstate, not able to appropriately eat to feed my baby. I ask that we finally stand up for the human rights that echo through the media every day, especially now. Without real support of paid family and medical leave for all, we cannot claim to be supporting family wellness or small business owners like me. After 10 months working at that organization, I left. I went back to my business knowing that at least I was in control of my future and the future of my family. With the right support, small business owners can better navigate the path to thriving within their communities and growing their businesses, now and in the long haul. Paid family medical leave will allow businesses to compete with large corporations who are able to provide this benefit, thus retaining the workforce in rural America and beyond. Passing paid family medical leave will mean other entrepreneurs and myself do not have to choose between our health, our loved ones, our income. I urge you to pass Senate File 1205 as the companion to House File 1200 and to continue advocating for this important investment for our families. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person is Tony Mangascow. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Yep. Hi, my name is Tony K. Mangascow. I don't have my video on. I'm recovering from a surgery, but I felt I really needed to be here to speak on behalf of paid family medical leave. So, Mr. Chair and committee members, my name, as I mentioned, is Tony K. Mangascow. I live in Rochester, Minnesota. And I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to testify today, and I appreciate the attention being paid to the importance of paid family leave. I'm here today on behalf of AARP to tell you about my family and my experience as a family caregiver and share why the paid family leave program in the House bill is a solution that can help all family caregivers. Minnesota's population is aging, and family caregivers are the backbone of our long-term care system. As a family caregiver, I have provided care for my son and daughter that have struggled with health issues starting in their teens. Eventually, I have gone on to share caregiving responsibilities with my siblings when my dad was diagnosed with end-stage heart and lung disease, and my mom was diagnosed with cancer. When my parents' health started to decline, I became guardian to my developmentally disabled brother. I officially became a member of the sandwich generation, caring for my kids, aging parents, and a brother. Caregiving is challenging and a full-time job, but my family has needed me. Working in healthcare, I hear from other caregivers that have similar experiences. Through the years, my role as a family caregiver has been a financial strain. During a nine-month period in 2017, I went without one-third of my yearly income due to unpaid time away from work. I have declared bankruptcy in the past. I wasn't able to afford unpaid time away from work, keep a roof over my children's heads, buy groceries, pay our utilities, and other necessary expenses along the way. In the last days of my mom's life, while in hospice care, because my family and I were so burnt out trying to juggle work, missed pay, and time away to be with her, she died alone without family at her bedside. My belief is if we had had paid family medical leave in place, the family would have been at her side in her last moments of life. I'm not sure what the future may bring for my family members. As guardian of my disabled brother, as a mother, and as a grandmother that has cared for her grandkids, I worry for their future along with my own. Having guaranteed paid time away from work to care for each other would ease so much stress related to any family's finances. As caregiving becomes the new normal, most of us likely will be caregivers during our lifetime. No one should ever have to live with choosing between not paying their bills and sacrificing their loved ones' well-being. Paid family medical leave should not rely on your employer's choice to offer a program. It is heartbreaking to hear families struggling, just like my own. We urge lawmakers to pass a comprehensive paid family and medical leave program available to all Minnesotans, not just a few. An army of family caregivers are counting on you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person on the list, and I believe this is the last person, Nancy Jost. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Noor and members of the committee, for the opportunity to be here with you today from Fergus. My name is Nancy Jost, and I'm here today in several roles. I work for West Central Initiative, which is one of the six Minnesota Initiative Foundations. I was a member of the Attorney General's Task Force on Women's Economic Security, and I'm a co-chair of the Prenatal to Three Coalition. I see one of my main jobs as ensuring the special challenges of our rural communities throughout the state and that we are included as we make decisions at the Capitol and in our state agencies. For that reason, I am here to strongly encourage members of the conference committee to accept the House position on paid family and medical leave. Piecemeal solutions won't solve the situation that we face in rural Minnesota. Our families must drive many more miles to give birth or manage any kind of serious health condition. I just heard that in two of our counties now in Region 4, a woman cannot give birth. She has to drive at least an hour to do that. Our elders are often further from their families. More of our families include people with disabilities. Childcare deserts, especially for infant care, are prevalent. And the counties with the highest workforce participation for women are in rural Minnesota. All of these create a greater need for paid leave. But unfortunately, our rural workers are less likely to have access. That means some people die alone, as we just heard. Some babies in the neonatal intensive care unit don't have a parent beside their incubator. Some people with cancer return to work too soon or put off treatment altogether with deadly consequences. Every one of our hard workers across the state, from new parents to those who care for elders, and often they do that at the same time, they deserve the same opportunity to earn access to paid leave. Only one proposal they will have it. And every one of our babies, the future workforce of our state, deserves to get off to the best start possible. And only one proposal will ensure that they will have that. The House provisions related to paid family and medical leave allow you to do what's right for families and our economy, especially those in rural Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Joss, for your testimony. Members, I believe that is the list of individuals signed up to testify on the paid family medical leave. Quite frankly, this will be a permanent, broad-based, comprehensive, and inclusive program, which we really needed at this moment. And it's based on the model based on the UI program. And quite frankly, this has been discussed, and we will like to continue having the conversation on the paid family medical leave. Members, any questions? Chair Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just so that all members know, the Senate's also passed a version of paid family leave that, you know, it was quite interesting when we had this conversation and looked back at statute to find out that the Department of Commerce actually prohibited insurance companies from coming in and writing these policies. And instead of, and so the Senate's taken a position that we should open up the marketplace and allow these, allow companies to come in and offer it, employers to compete at a level playing field. Not to mandate it, but to allow them to compete, because we're hearing from small businesses that they want to be able to offer this benefit to attract employees, because as we've said, everybody's fighting for talent at this point. Many of us, you know, question the assumptions that are in the House provision. In fact, it was just reported earlier this year that Washington's program, which was implemented in 2020, was forecasting a cash deficit by about the first quarter of this year and is having to increase their premiums by 50%. So, members, I think it's important to understand that there are two different programs out there, one that relies on, you know, on opening up the Department of Commerce, opening up options for employers and employees, and one that's a heavy-handed mandate that that forces everyone to be the same and not to compete for talent, but to offer a program that will quite honestly cause most private employers that are offering this to step away. So just to let you know and to reiterate, the Senate does have a position on this.
Thank you, Chair Pratt. I think we appreciate the Senate now moving towards paid family medical leave, because that's what we've been trying to make sure that we can discuss. But nevertheless, I think our program, the way it's designed, and I think we've learned from what other states have done, and we have a strong system here, this will be a more comprehensive. With the Senate provision, it's more selective for those who want it rather than providing it for everyone. And quite frankly, if you are a low-income person who works for an employer who is not interested in adding additional cost to them, they're not going to purchase that UI. It's more selective process. What we're proposing is everyone should be included. And that's something I think it's more based on having a system that is working and a state system that we believe is going to be functional. We've seen how the UI system really works. It's one of our best social safety net program that we have in the state. Why not look into how that system has worked efficiently, which we're doing in this bill, and then replicate that process and to be more inclusive for less than a cup of coffee a week. For less than a cup of coffee a week, we can provide a paid family medical leave for every employer in the state of Minnesota. If you are also a self-employed, you are able to buy into that. Guess what? Many women, I think you have seen the article, they are facing more mental health situation, physical health. They're seeing many, you know, challenges because they've got to get back to work immediately after having birth. Where is the compassion for those who are asking us to act? when you're sick and you're taking care of your loved one, instead of taking care of them, you're thinking about going back to work. This is helping individuals with their mental health, their physical health, their spiritual health, all those things taken into account. Minnesota will become an island if we don't do it. More than a dozen states have already implemented paid family medical leave. What are we waiting for? I think this is the right direction that we can do as a state to make sure we attract employees to the state. You've heard from the commissioner. We're putting a marketing process. Employers, you know, Minnesota is one of the best states when it comes to retaining businesses for more than 5 years. We are one of the highest worker participation in the country. We are highest in many other aspects, but we fail when it comes to low income, BIPOC individuals. We fail when it comes to women, economic security. We fail in many aspects. We can correct those things by providing programs that are proven, practical solutions that will serve everybody. And our paid family medical leave, quite frankly, addresses that challenge rather than being more selective and a choice, which is just not existence because employers are already providing paid family medical leave for those who are in high earning income, those who work for big corporations, those who are wealthy and well-connected are receiving this benefit, but not those who deserve. The lowest income individuals in the state of Minnesota deserve to be included in the paid family medical leave. Representative Susinski.
Thank you, Chair Noor. And, you know, I just would potentially, you know, I appreciate Senator Pratt's comments that, you know, the Department of Commerce is, you know, limiting access to those tools in the toolbox and those products. You know, I think the argument against, you know, single-payer paid family leave, you know, is an important one. I think that's something we need to take into debate. And I think, you know, the Senate's plan needs to have a good go of it, and we need to look at that on a first basis, not simply open a single-payer family leave plan here in Minnesota as a first step, but really look at what employees and employers can do on their own terms. When it comes to negotiation, whether they want to come to work for a certain company or not. And, you know, I think your point was well taken that said, you know, what do they want? Well, let's let those folks decide what they want. Let's let the employer, if they need to get employees in the door, you know, there are products available within this country that those businesses could purchase, but because of what we're doing here in Minnesota, we limit that access to those products. And, you know, I think that would be, you know, a decent, good step so that those businesses could. And I think if you look at your bill, you know, if some of the companies potentially already offer those programs, you know, they would be exempted from it if they have something that meets or exceeds it, if I'm not correct. But, you know, that's, you know, those big businesses. And, you know, there's a lot of small businesses that do not want it, yet they won't be able to opt out. And, you know, I think that's unfortunate.
Thank you, Representative Susinski, for that comment. I think in our bill, if any employer has got a good program better than what we offer in the state, they can keep that program. And that's the beauty of the program. We're giving people choice and that option within the system. Likewise, I think we're providing protections. The Senate version does not provide any protections. If any employee requests paid family medical leave and you're laid off, you don't have the protections that we built into this system. And quite frankly, also when you are receiving other programs within the system, whether it's social services and other programs, we want to make sure that that small income that you're getting to help you with your financial security, you are protected. So the protections that exist in our bill does not exist on the Senate side. And it's not comparable to apples. It's totally a different program with different outcomes. Our program is more comprehensive, broad-based, and unique in nature because we're using a system that is functional. We're one of the best states when it comes to the unemployment system because we built it. We have the best system. And when people talk about system, millars, and all those things, it doesn't exist because we do have a very strong system in our state that we can replicate immediately and hit the ground. We should take advantage of that. When we have an economic boom, when we have the surplus, the unique surplus we have, this program will be the right time to implement so that when we do have some challenges, as we go through the system that we can offer workers and employers the option to be able to receive financial security. That's the intent of this whole program, and we can do it. See no further discussion on this topic. We'll move to the next, Article 16, the warehouse safety workers. I would like to welcome Mr. Taylor Hamilton and also Ms. Khalil Jama to the testify table. So please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hello. Okay, seems like it's working. My name is Tyler Hamilton. I am an Amazon worker. I've worked at Amazon for nearly 5 years now. A couple different departments and shifts, so I've worked my way around the warehouse. And this bill is important. Amazon doesn't have such a high rate of injury for no reason. Like, if you go into a warehouse and you physically look at it inside, it looks pretty nice. It looks relatively clean and organized. And yet the injury rates are ridiculous. And since the last time I was in this room, maybe a couple of months ago, many of my coworkers, like our fellow Minnesotans, have gotten injured in very painful, some of them can be very life-lasting ways. And the root cause of this, why is Amazon so different from other companies, is their business model, their rates, their quotas that you hear of. Just like, you know, a long time ago, there was the Ford system, Toyota made the Toyota system of production. New technologies has allowed Amazon to innovate in some ways that are very good or helpful, economically speaking, but also some ways that are extremely detrimental to the welfare of workers. And Amazon is essentially the industrialization of retail, which is going to be, I'm sure, in hindsight, viewed as a huge event. And there's no way the way that Amazon does things will not spread to other companies and other areas of our economy. Which is why, for some of the negatives, like the ridiculous injury rates, it's really important that we do things now, and we make sure that we have the tools and the laws in the books to prevent all of these injuries. There, in all of the people that I've talked with, I've known so many people who have worked with me at Amazon. Some of the best people, the smartest people, the hardest workers, they are not vulnerable to being hurt. Absolutely not. Only like a week or two ago, there was a nice lady I was talking to. She had just re-entered the workforce. She was a mom. She was, you know, taking care of her kids for 17 years. Her first job back was Amazon. That's maybe a little bit of a doozy of a job, but she was worried. She was stressed. And she was aching, which is, for the repetitive stress, repetitive motion injuries that dominated Amazon, the first signs of more serious things. And luckily, because I've been there for so long, I knew how to try and like get the data to see how is she doing that day, right? To disclose that, to show her how she's doing, which, you know, it doesn't cost anything. You type some keys on a keyboard, right? You print off a piece of paper, which costs a few cents. It doesn't require very much from companies. And when I looked at how she was doing and I pulled that information, she was literally one of the best performers that shift. And she was stressed and worried and frustrated that she was going to lose her job because there was no disclosure. No one was telling her, and she had no way of finding out because there were no systems for that. And while there's many companies who are fully compliant for, you know, just you have an employee, you tell them what the expectations are. You tell them how they're doing. You know, it seems like common sense. And there's most companies do that already. But Amazon is a huge employer in Minnesota. Thousands and thousands of employees. At my warehouse alone, there's at least, from discussions that I've heard from like management and HR, there are at least 10,000 former employees from my warehouse alone. And that's a lot of Minnesotans. And if you look at the injury rates for people with horrible injuries for their knees or for their backs or their other joints and muscles, that adds up really quickly. I think I heard one of the reports, 1 in 9 people. 10,000 people is a lot of people, and we just need to take care of our people better as a state. And at this point, most of you have seen news reports, you've heard stories, you've heard me or my coworkers before talk about safety, how important it is, our own injuries, our own aches and pains. I've never had back issues or knee issues, except for working at Amazon. It just happens, even when you're young and healthy like me. But I ask of you, even those of you who might not agree on all things, to please at least consider and do what you can so we take care of Minnesotan safety. It's the least that we can do. So thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person is Ms. Jama. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi, my name is Kali Jama. I've been working at Amazon less than 4 months now. I got hired for stowing area, so I've never had a back injury. But I've been having a lot of back pain because of the job work and the pressure that they put on you.
Can you get closer to the mic there, please?
Can you hear me?
Speak a little bit louder.
Okay. So, hi. My name is Kali Jama. I work at Amazon. I haven't been there for long. I've been there less than 4 months now. But I've been having a lot of backache because of what I've been doing. The job workload is really getting heavier besides of what they hired us for. And I'm doing two jobs as one person. And it's just been so difficult trying to work, being safe, and also having a pressure of management coming to you and telling you you have to reach certain rates. And which is not fair to me because what I do and what I get paid for is not together. So it's just been so difficult working there, and I'm worried for my own safety. I have two teenagers that play ball, and sometimes I can't play because of my back aches of what I do. There's a job that I started getting training for called Water Spider, which you upload all these orders that you bring in. And when I did the second day, I did not want to do that position anymore. So I stick to my stowing, which it was easier. But now we're doing both at the same time. And I don't think that's fair. And I really, really appreciate if we get the support when it comes to safety. I'm only 39, but I'm still don't want to have a backache getting to a certain age and just dealing with that pressure with the rates where people are literally fearing to get fired if you don't make a certain amount throughout that night. And it's a 10-hour shift, and it's not easy. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Jama, for your testimony. Members, any discussion on Article 16 in the House provision? Chair Eklund.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to say I came from an industry that at one point in time had a very high incident rate, and the company and the unions got together and put together a good program and brought it down. In this day and age when we have workforce issues, there's absolutely no reason that our workers go home hurt. And so I appreciate this provision. We need to take care of workers so that we know that they'll be safe and injury-free when they go back to work the next day. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Eklund. I think it's important for us to look into the safety for the workers because the safety of the workers is the economic success of the employers. So I think this is something worthy of us looking into in this conference. The next section we have is Article 14 and 15, which is unsafe and sick time. I'd like to ask Robert Hyder to join us if he's around. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Snor and Pratt and members of the committee. My name is Robert Hyder, and I'm the policy director at Take Action Minnesota. We are a multiracial people's organization building power for government and economy that work for all of us. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. We all know that everyone gets sick, and the pandemic was one more reminder, albeit extreme, that when people get sick, they should be able to stay home, not just for their own health or for that of a loved one, but for the health of all of those that they may come in contact with. Our organization is here to support the inclusion of Earn Sick and Safe Time into the final bill because Minnesotans care for one another, and we want ours to be a caring state where families can be healthy and safe. 14 states, the District of Columbia, and at least 30 cities across the nation, including Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, and soon to be joined by Bloomington, probably within the next month or so, have already implemented sick and safe leave policies. Now, throughout the pandemic, our organization has heard from members in central Minnesota working in food service who did not have 1 hour of paid sick leave. It was typical for their coworkers to show up sick to work because they didn't have another choice. We've had members testify on this issue at the Capitol for years, including Ray from St. Cloud, who has been forced to show up to work sick, working in multiple retail and early education jobs. Growing up, they got in trouble for missing high school to care for their brother with a chronic illness because their parents didn't have access to paid sick days. At the same time, we also hear the benefits of paid sick days. One story came from a cook in St. Paul. In his 60s, he worked back at the house throughout the pandemic and has been a godsend to his employer in this labor market. When he was out for surgery this year, he received paid sick time. Not only did this help cover additional medical expenses, it also affirmed that his labor mattered. His employer would not have survived the pandemic without committed workers like him, and this basic employment standard is common sense. Caring for yourself and family members is essential to living a good life and being able to work with dignity. Earned sick and safe time is good for working people and for our communities. It upholds the dignity of Minnesota workers and protects people from losing their jobs or facing workplace discipline when they need time to care. We ask that you include earned sick and safe time in your final bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Saida, for the testimony. Members, any question? Seeing none, we'll try to do quickly some of the testifiers on the list here. Please make it within a minute or so we can cover everybody else. Mr. Joel Johnson, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor. My name is Joel Johnson. I'm here on behalf of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers State Council. Before I start, I'd like to thank our House author, Representative Lizelgard, as well as Chair Eklund and Senator Rarick for their patience and help in getting this issue finally where I believe we have language that's acceptable to all sides and I think does balance safety with the cost and the amount of time that it's going to take to replace an entire system of load control meters. So we appreciate the help there. I also do want to add, too, that I think the reason that we were able to move forward is because of a recognition of all of the things that we can work together to help make cooperative members' lives better and put our members to work, things like EV infrastructure, weatherization, you know, all of these things, you know, solar installations and storage. These are all important things that are for us to move forward on, and we look forward to working with you on them as well. Thank you.
Thank you so much. The next person on the list is Mike Poole. Welcome. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mike Poole with the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. And like my friend Joel, I do want to thank Representative Lizelgard, Representative Eklund, Senator Rarick for their patience and their leadership as we were working through some pretty difficult issues over the last actually 2 or 3 years now. So we're really happy that we were able to bring legislation to you to sort of get us through this load control replacement tech renewal program that a bunch of our co-ops are ready to, you know, tens of thousands of these load control receivers that need to be replaced around the state in a relatively, you know, short amount of time. The agreement that we've come to gives us an 8-year on-ramp in order to replace those. We have a number of co-ops, though, whose tech renewal ramp-up extends beyond that 2030 date. So we are going to have to revisit that sunset at some point. But the agreement that we've come to will allow, this is the, as I said before, this is the O in ECO. This is the Energy Conservation and Optimization Act wants utilities, encourages utilities to do, to optimize their systems, and these load control receivers are what is used to optimize demand response programs for customers. So we want the utilities to be able to do this without a lot of difficulty and a lot of extra expense, and the agreement we've come to will allow that to happen. So I do appreciate my friends at the IBEW, Center for Energy and Environment, the Electrical Association, Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. We've all been working to come together around this proposal. It kind of reminds Senator Rarick of the ECO Coalition itself. We did bring the same sort of attention to this as we did with ECO.
Well, thank you so much for your testimony. The next person on the list is Meg Luga-Nicolai. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chairs Noor and Pratt. My name is Meg Luger-Nicolai, and I am an attorney with Education Minnesota, but I'm also the labor representative to the Public Employment Relations Board. And I am here to speak in favor of the House language on this, which provides full funding at $525,000 a year and provides some policy changes that will help our operations. Until July 1st of last year, the Public Employment Relations Board operated to resolve public sector disputes in the most efficient and cost-effective way possible. And we did so on a shoestring budget, which is the same budget that's currently in the Senate side. It is impossible for us to hire a full-time employee. MMB will not let us hire people when we can't pay them. And that's generally my disposition in my day job as well. So we've only been able to hire a part-time employee at 0.3, and we've basically been able to recruit very nice, extremely competent, but mostly retired people who are willing to give of themselves during their retirement. So that's not like a long-term strategy for staffing. Couple of the reasons that we support the House language. First of all, it restores our jurisdiction. Our doors have opened and closed. That means there's some confusion among employees and advocates regarding who's in charge of handling unfair labor practices. So this allows our doors to remain open. Secondly, it provides the funding that we need to properly staff and serve the public and public sector employees and employers. Third, it makes two minor changes that enable us to conduct our deliberative work in the way that other boards in Minnesota do. That means that we can consider decisions and decision-making in a closed session under the open meeting law. It also means that data that is non-public in the hands of, for example, a public employer would remain non-public in our hands as well. So we're just ensuring that there's an alignment between the two types of data. So those are things that we are really in need of having happen. We are very excited to see them in the House bill and grateful for their inclusion, and we hope that we move forward. I have come before this body and before the House, and I've done a lot of begging. Consider this to be my most abject posture. We really, really, really need this funding and jurisdiction in order to best fulfill the mission that the legislature set forth for us when this language was adopted. Thank you. Oh, sorry, one more thing. I, of course, in my day job, do represent Education Minnesota. We support the UI changes and really want to thank Representative Greenman for her work on this. We have worked really hard to make it as cost neutral as possible to districts. So hopefully we can align the different types of work and make sure folks' eligibility is similar, irrespective of whom they work for. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person is Professor Laura. Quick question from Chair Pratt.
Thank you, Ms. Luger-Nicolai. Just real quick, how many cases has the PERB taken?
37.
Okay, I thought it was 31.
It may be, pretty sure. I will double check and get back to you, Chair Pratt. Thank you, Chair Noor. Sorry.
Do you know how many have been successfully resolved by the PERB?
You can proceed.
The number that we have, so we have, well, almost all of them. I will tell you that there are a few outstanding, either waiting for hearing or in mediation, but we have successfully resolved probably about 85% of those cases.
Okay, because the data that I have suggests 77% were withdrawn or dismissed. Only one went to court, and many of the other cases were resolved through mediation without the PERB.
Proceed.
Chair Pratt, so we would first of all consider a withdrawal or dismissal to be a successful resolution because it means that we aided the parties in understanding that this wasn't a dispute that was covered by PELRA. Secondly, none of them went to court because we have a hearing officer process, and so that individual would have heard the case. And thirdly, we did enlist the assistance of the Bureau because that's also part of the statutory framework for PERB is to rely on the Bureau for some of the resolution of those cases because they have mediating services. Now, if we are to be fully staffed, we will have more personnel who can assist in those processes, but we were kind of dependent on the kindness of our sister agency.
Chair Pratt.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Luger-Nicolai, I guess I'm looking at this and saying, you know, 77% either withdrawn or dismissed would suggest that this probably isn't needed. And we already have a Bureau of Mediation Services that would take this on. It seems very duplicative to me. So I'll just leave it at that, Mr. Chair.
With that, Chair Pratt, we do have Professor Laura Cooper, who can give us a little bit of insight. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chairman Noor and Pratt and members of the committee, and thank you for this opportunity to speak to the pending legislation regarding the PERB. Just in further answer to Senator Pratt's question, the term withdrawn is quite misleading in the context of our procedure. Cases are typically withdrawn only after the agency has done a thorough investigation of the case, and in which we have written a fully detailed proposed decision with regard to the complaint, describing all the facts and the relevant application of PERB. Under the rules and the statute as written, before we can take a case to hearing or dismiss the case, we have to give a party an opportunity to withdraw its charge. And so what you don't see are the many cases in which we have spent hours and hours on a case, fully investigating and deliberating on it, and giving a party an opportunity to withdraw. Let me tell you a bit about my background. My name is Laura Cooper. I'm the neutral member of PERB, appointed to represent the public interest. I've been a member of the board since its inception. I'm a professor emerita at the University of Minnesota Law School, where I taught labor law for 42 years and held an endowed chair in alternative dispute resolution. The Minnesota legislature created PERB to better serve its citizens' interests in high-quality public services and fair treatment of government employees. It removed state courts' jurisdiction to adjudicate unfair labor practices and instead believed that this agency, with members with real-life labor experience, could more efficiently resolve these labor disputes, in the public interest. The statute that created PERB specified the process to be followed. Cases needed to be investigated upon receipt of charges. We needed to determine whether complaints should be issued. Cases that were suitable for hearing needed to go before professional hearing officers, and those hearing officers needed thereafter to be reviewed by the PERB members. And sometimes cases have gone further as needed to court. The statute says what kind of employees we're supposed to have: investigators, hearing officers, and a general counsel. It is obvious that $125,000 a year is wholly inadequate to have any permanent employees, let alone this kind of necessary staff. The sound public policy that is represented in the statute that created PERB simply cannot be fulfilled with the present resources. We urge an adequate budget being funded for PERB so that the legislature's public policy can be realized. Thank you for that consideration. I wholly endorse Ms. Luger-Nicolai's statements with regard to the language issues for PERB as well.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Professor. Mr. Chair, I think we have a session starting at 4, and then there's also other items. I don't know if anybody wanted to add any issues that we've discussed. We have a few individuals who have not testified yet, but I just wanted to make sure we are on time. If we can allow them next time to come and testify, it's only a small group of folks, and continue with our work on the conference and what's ahead coming up in tomorrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess, you know, we've had a lot of testimony today. We've had a lot of questions and debate. I would offer that all of those that didn't get a chance to testify be able to submit their testimony in writing, but quite honestly, we have a lot of work to do. Our leaders came up with the framework of an agreement that you and I are responsible for putting the finishing touches on, and I think our time is best used in that endeavor. So with that, Mr. Chair, upon adjournment, I would suggest that we intend to reconvene tomorrow at 1 o'clock or the call of the chair, so that we have time to work through the remaining issues and get a bill done yet this week. I do really apologize to the people that didn't get a chance to testify. I know some of them, and they would have done a great job, but we did have a lot of good discussion today, and I think we just have to, in order to get our work done, go that direction.
Just wanted to thank all the folks who signed up to testify. We know the issues you're fighting for. We'll keep on fighting for through the conference committee. So I appreciate you being with us, and maybe we'll have other options. Mr. Chair, I just wanted to inquire if we're going to be adopting same and similar sections tomorrow if we do have that opportunity.
Chair Noor, I would hope that we could adopt some same and similars. I know you and I had intended to get together at 4 o'clock, but we're going to have to put that on delay as the House goes into session, and I believe you're going into session, right?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Yeah. Session starts at 4 p.m.
And so maybe we can come together tomorrow, tonight or sometime tomorrow, and work through the details of that.
Thank you so much, Chair Pratt. With that, members, we are now adjourned.